Support for Boston Public Radio comes from New England Recovery Center, providing inpatient addiction treatment in state-of-the-art facilities located in Westboro, Mass. All major insurance plans accepted. Learn more at newenglandrecoverycenter.org.
And Eastern Bank, committed to helping people and businesses prosper by investing over $240 million in local charities since 1994. Eastern Bank. Join us for good. EasternBank.com. Member FDIC.
Today on Boston Public Radio, a recent poll shows that the one thing that unites us is we're in agreement on how divided we are. Now there's geographical research illustrating how state lines affect party lines. It turns out Massachusetts could be the most politically intolerant state in the country. We'll open the lines and ask you, how did the birthplace of democracy become a hotbed for partiality? Then there really is life after death. After their 21-year-old son died, parents have obtained a court order to harvest his sperm to continue the family line. But this post-mortem paternity is raising all kinds of complexities about consent and regulation. We'll talk to Art Kaplan about this and more.
An opinion piece for the Boston Globe argues that despite being victims of anti-Semitism, many Jews are perpetuating white supremacy. And as you can imagine, the Globe is getting lots of pushback. Shirley Leung, the paper's interim editorial page editor, joins us for that and more next on Boston Public Radio. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Good morning, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. How are you?
Good.
So, Boston, we have a problem. A new study reported on in this morning's Globe finds that the most politically intolerant county in America appears to be Suffolk County, from which we are broadcasting. This research, which was conducted by The Atlantic and the polling and analytics firm PredictWise, found that it's not just Suffolk County. All Massachusetts counties appear to be among the most prejudiced against the political other, as they call them. When you look at the factors that correlate with political prejudice, it doesn't come as a huge surprise, I guess you'd say. According to their study, the most politically intolerant Americans tend to be whiter, more highly educated, older, more urban. In other words, a lot of people who live here. We're going to take your calls at 877-301-8970. Does this ring true for you? Are you among the politically intolerant? Can you name one friend or a family member who you love and respect who is of the opposite political persuasion? And if we live in the most politically intolerant state, is there any hope of becoming more tolerant? Or does that whole idea give you hives? Our number is 877-301-8970. I did a little research, Margaret.
Yep.
It took me about 30 seconds.
Yep.
How many counties are there in America?
I have no idea.
3,402.
Oh, my God.
There are 3,007 counties. There are several hundred parishes and county-like entities. 3,400 counties in America. And according to their research, we're the most intolerant county in America. The first paragraph of the Atlantic story even expands on the notion. It says, we know that Americans have become more biased against one another based on partisan affiliation over the past several decades. Most of us now discriminate against members of the other political side explicitly and implicitly. Listen to this. In hiring, dating, and marriage, as well as judgments of patriotism, compassion, and even physical attractiveness, according to recent research. So I guess we're number one. 877-301-8970. Are they describing you?
Well, you know, it's funny. I remember doing a story when I was at the Herald years ago about lunch dates. And the guy
I remember the story.
Dates,
go ahead.
This
yeah,
is
I
long
this.
Before
I
Trump
do.
Even came into
I
the
do.
Picture.
Yeah.
And the guy at lunch date said there's incredible women. Well, men don't really care. As long as she's good looking, they're fine. But women are very discriminated. They don't want to, in Massachusetts, where most people are either independent or Democratic or certainly independent-leaning Democrats, they don't want to date any Republicans. I thought that was really interesting. Now, it's in the Trump era, I've heard this over and over again. We've heard it on our show where people who are married, this is becoming a huge problem.
People get divorced over
yes,
the Trump
and,
thing.
And I have heard this from, one of my kids' friends. I mean, this is a big deal. They don't want to date someone who's a Trump supporter.
Yeah, but even if Trump has created aberrational mm-hmm. divides, we're still number one. Donald Trump is president yep. of all 3,400 counties, not just Suffolk County and the other counties in Massachusetts. Our counties, Suffolk and the others in Massachusetts, are the most or among the most, in the case of the non-Suffolks, intolerant counties in the United States of America. You know, speaking
Did you
of
say the problem with us here? that were whiter, more highly educated, older. Okay, that's
according to them.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I used to work for years at the Boston Herald, and the Boston Herald is a much more conservative right wing paper than the Boston and the Boston Globe. And working there did change my perspective on the these supposedly holier than thou Democrats up on Beacon Hill. I began to discover that the shenanigans and the corruption and all that in Massachusetts. Where was it, Jim? For the
how
most
long have
part?
We been working with each other?
It was with the Democrats and
we've
not
been
the Republicans.
With each other 19 years.
Yes, we have.
Would you? Oh, actually, longer counting that under the radar television
the
show
radar
is Alex
it was,
Beam used
it was
to call
award-winning.
It on at NECN. Actually, it did win an award too, which is shocking.
That's right.
And shows that awards don't mean anything anymore. But if I were to say to you when I first met you and we started working with each other, whatever time it was, in 2019, and I think this is a fair statement, I am a more politically tolerant person than you are, you would have said that is not even remotely possible. Wouldn't you have said that? And that is true.
You are more politically tolerant now.
I am now, exactly.
Oh, much more. Oh, you were such
you were total,
a purist left-wing nut when
well,
I first met you.
I wouldn't go that far. I don't think that's
absolutely
appropriate.
And I was on the other side.
But you
I
were totally out
much
of control now.
I think in my
you know what
case,
Marjorie says during the breaks, by the way? Marjorie often says, particularly when we're discussing Donald Trump, she turns. We only have minute breaks here because we don't have commercials.
Yep.
She says to me, I got to calm down. I can't. Do I sound shrill? I can't be shrill. I can't sound shrill. I got to calm down. So you are part of – I know you live in Norfolk County, but
Jim,
work in Suffolk County.
That's right. I live in Norfolk County, and I think living in Brookline. If they added Brookline and Cambridge onto the Suffolk County study, I mean, it would
be
like
the
to
charts.
The moon. Forget about it.
I know.
We would be so –
That's a very good
But, you
point.
Know, it's funny because I was much more, when I first knew you, of a libertarian. I was a big fan of Bill Weld. There were a lot of Republicans that I liked.
You were also an anti-taxer, which you were not anymore. You were. Don't try to say you were.
I was.
You
I
were.
Was. I Well, because
I've educated you, obviously.
Well, no, that's not true. Because I was not living in Suffolk County when I was a kid, and I saw what these insane tax rates in Massachusetts did to poor towns like
they
my own.
They were insane.
That's, well, they were insane.
No, you didn't understand them. That's
yeah,
why
okay.
you thought they were insane.
Jim, let's face it. If you get a house where the tax bill is $3,000 and the whole house is worth $9,000, it's a problem. You know, it's a problem.
You
so
know,
anyway.
We're making light of this, but does it not trouble you that we are
well,
working?
Well, here's my argument.
We are working this minute in the single most
That's
intolerant
right.
county in the United States of America.
But here's my argument.
What is it?
Is that it was bad before, but it's taken on a whole new level now. And it's as much about issues now. Well, it was always about issues, I suppose, to a certain degree. But it's really become... It's become Trumpified. It's just become...
Yeah, but as I said, the other 3,399 counties have Donald Trump as president too. So there's a common thread through all of them. And we are the least able to handle these political differences, which I think should be somewhat troubling. Some may wear it as a badge of honor. I don't know.
I do have some people in my family that are Trumpsters. I've told you that.
I'm aware of that. 877-301-897. Let's take some calls. Maria on the Cape, you were first on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for calling. Hi. Are they talking about you?
Yes, unfortunately, they are. I'm an educated person of color. I'm kind to everyone. But it is really, I find it more and more difficult. I'm not really seeking friends who are Republicans. We have different value systems. So, you know, getting close to somebody with a different value system is difficult. And again, I'm kind to everybody, but I don't have the privilege of being a Republican because those policies affect my brothers and sisters, people of color.
Mm-hmm.
So
well,
does that make sense?
No,
yes.
It makes total sense.
It's a total great argument. And, you know, I can't fathom how anybody who's an African American, they have this great piece, Maria, about the difficult road for those few African Americans who are with Trump and how they just get berated from all sides, because it is true. I think he's shown himself to be a racist, so it'd be very hard to support this guy.
So, Maria, even though your explanation is totally clear and makes sense to me, it's a horrible way to live, isn't it?
It's really sad because there, you know, in my social world, because I have an education now, I have economic privilege, and so you know, some of the world that I go in often is very white, very privileged, and it narrows down the friendships that I'm allowing myself to have, and I feel bad about that, but I just can't connect to the thought process that goes behind it, because I know that those policies so affect and I'm a Latina. I'm a Black Latina. So mm-hmm. those policies affect my people. They affect me. You know what I mean? They really do.
Maria, that was a fabulous first
call. Maria,
before you go,
now that you said you're a Latina, what do you make of the notion that I think there's an assumption, because African Americans have been very strong against Donald Trump, Latinas not so much, and there's this assumption the Democrats have that the Latina vote is going to be with them, but you do see, especially people that have been here for a couple of generations, moving away from the Democrats and more toward the Republicans.
David Bernstein, our colleague, wrote that piece in Politico last week.
Second and third generation Hispanics are much more conservative. So what do you make of that? What's that about?
I don't know. You know, my grandparents, it's still fresh for me that they came from other countries, the Cape Verde Islands and Puerto Rico. So I understand what that struggle is. And I don't understand how you can separate from that. How, you know what I mean? It's very real to me. I grew up in an ethnic enclave with, you know, people of color who were marginalized and working as landscapers and chefs and cooks. And from our experience with the educated people we work for, they helped us to navigate the system. So now my cousins and myself, we're all educated. So there were benefits to that, but I can never, it's sort of like, don't forget your roots, but bloom where you're planted. Does that make sense?
You're amazing. Maria, call us again soon, will you? Thanks for the call. 877-301-8970. I'm sorry, Marjorie.
Melissa from Oxford. What do you think, Melissa?
Hey there.
Hi. How are you guys doing?
Great.
Good. I grew up in Needham, spent about 2 decades out in Western Mass in the Northampton area, and now live in Oxford, which is in Worcester County.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to tell you, it's very different here in Worcester County. I don't know if you guys know from other callers.
Oh, we do.
There are a lot of Trump supporters, around here, and it's hard for me. It's been hard for me, like your other caller said, to make friends around here. I'm very cautious at school drop-off and pick-up amongst the other parents because I don't know who are Trump supporters because there are so many of them.
Well, you mean so when you say you're very careful, myself. Meaning you're careful not to say something that may cause a to-do? Yeah, I understand that.
Absolutely. Yep, absolutely. And it's just hard because, like your other caller said, it's the set of morals. It's what makes people up. And it's just hard for me to separate that from just, you know, I don't know.
Melissa, another honest, fine call. Thank you for making it. You know, Marjorie, when I read this opening paragraph from the Atlantic reporting on this, that explicit and implicit discrimination, hiring, dating, marriage, you know what just came to my mind? I've told this story before, and I assume most people have seen it. Larry David, who's brilliant, on Curb Your Enthusiasm. I'm going to get this a little bit wrong, but I'm going to get it mostly right. Part of the deal he made with his wife on TV Wife, from whom he's now divorced, I guess, right, was that if they lasted 10 years or something like
that
he was allowed to have one affair.
Yes.
Okay.
One night stand.
That's what it was. One night stand. And, you know, he says it's 10 years. We got here and she's not happy about it, but they made a deal, et cetera. So he finds this woman who I think is an actress or something. And the whole show, John Parker, who knows 10 times more about these things than I do, is nodding. I'm pretty close, John, so far. I got it. Okay. So he ends up in the dressing room of this beautiful actress who he is going to have the one-night stand with. And you see him sitting on the couch. He says, can you wait a minute, Larry, while I change into something more comfortable? And, you know, he's like literally salivating, whatever. And he leans back on the couch waiting for her to come out in some lingerie or something, at which point he leans back, looks at the picture on her dressing room table, and it's a photograph of George W. Bush, at which point he gets up and runs out of the room. And I don't know if that's the end of the episode, but it's sort of a variation on this theme.
Yeah, no, that was a pretty good one.
Suffolk County is the most intolerant county in America, according to this reporting by The Atlantic and some group called PredictWise.
This is an email from Tony. He says, irony, isn't it ironic that you're the most intolerant county in America and also considered one of the most racist?
Well, that's
interesting, isn't it?
Good point. You know, I revisited last night. I had Paul English, you know, from Kayak and Lola and everything, in the man who started with Liz Walker and others the effort to build a memorial to Martin Luther King, Reverend Jeff Brown, who, you know, was also on. And I put up again that incredible survey that the Boston Globe did during their series last year on racism in Boston in 2018 or 2017, where we're the least welcoming city to African Americans, voted by African Americans in the United States of America. So it is a horrible coming together of two
firsts.
I think we
need kind of a Suffolk County-wide therapy, Jim, is what we need. We need to come to terms with our difficulties.
But we're making light of this. I mean, it is a little troubling that we live and work in the most intolerant part of the country. I understand, as Maria and Melissa said, you know, it's about ideology. There's some things that matter to you so much, and I probably fall prey to that too. But that is disturbing that you can't talk to certain people, you can't have a relationship with certain. I mean,
well, it's kind of like, though, I mean, people. What have people talked about the call? They've talked about morals and values.
Mm-hmm.
So, if you thought someone that you met or had lousy values,
you're right.
Thought that, you know, we should do what this administration has done, take babies away from their mothers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, you probably wouldn't want to hang around with that person.
Yeah, but I guess my point, I'm not quarreling with that at all. Maria made that point beautifully, as you just did. But it's a horrible way to live when you have to say, you know, they're the other. It's just, it's not a good way to have to live your life. In any case, we've got to take a break. 877-301-8970.
Okay, we're talking about the mess here in Suffolk County. A new study that declares Massachusetts the most politically intolerant state in the entire United States, and Suffolk County the most politically intolerant county of thousands in America. We're taking your calls and asking you, is this a problem? The conversation continues on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And if you're just tuning in, we're talking about a new study. It's reported in this morning's Globe from The Atlantic and a place called, was it PredictWise, I guess is a surveying firm, that finds Massachusetts is the most politically intolerant state in America and the single most intolerant county in America of 3,400 counties is the one we're broadcasting from, Suffolk. Have you been on the receiving end of someone's political prejudice? Have you perpetuated it? 877-301-8970. And these seem to be facts. Are you troubled by the fact that we are intolerant of the other, as it says, in record sort of numbers?
By the way, we nonetheless have elected a Republican in Massachusetts, which is very interesting.
But a Democratic-like Republican. I mean, I thought about that this morning. Well, we do elect Republicans, but Charlie Baker's is close to a Democrat amongst Republicans.
The question. There were a lot of Democratic-like Republicans, if you want to call it that, years ago. Republicans who were in favor of climate change issues, Republicans who were in favor of choice.
Oh, you mean more moderate Republicans.
Yes.
That's a good point.
And I think that's part of the problem, too, this extremism. I mean, we'll talk later on about that, the gun vote in Congress,
mm-hmm.
where like 90-some percent of gun owners are in favor of more reasonable
background checks. Yeah.
But you have a Republican Congress that's not. So
but I think you're missing the point
the
here.
Problem.
You're explaining the divide in the country, and I think you're explaining it perfectly well. The issue is not is there a deep divide. The issue is why is the divide in the county in which we are standing deeper than in any county in the United States of America?
Well,
that, to me,
couldn't be another thing, you know.
What is it?
People like me, my people, the Irish. The Irish Brian are not known for our tolerance.
Brian in Boston, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Welcome to the show. Hi.
Hey, how are you? First
Excellent.
Time caller.
Oh, thank you.
But a long time listener. Yes, I don't know. I have trouble with the term political intolerance as though like conservatives were some protected class or a race or something.
Yeah.
You know, conservatives are conservative because they think conservatively and they live in a place where people think liberally. So isn't that kind of setting, I don't know, I think that term is setting a slippery slope.
Yeah, but again, we're not the only place where the majority of people are of the liberal persuasion. I mean, as evident, that's number one. I mean, the coasts are pretty much that way from top to bottom, right? So again, the issue for me, Brian, is why are we the outlier? I understand we have the demographic difference here is one that explains part of it, but it's not San Francisco, whatever county that's in. It's not other liberal counties in Oregon or Washington State. It's right here in Boston.
Wow.
How do you explain that?
Well, I don't have a problem with being intolerant of racism and being intolerant of propping up the coal industry. And, you know, I'm very proud of my liberal values.
That's good.
Well, you know, it could be that we're just smarter here in the Suffolk County. You know, we're not supposed to be say that kind of thing, but we do have the smartest kids in the Massachusetts schools, don't we?
We do. Brian, thanks for your first call.
Here's
I hope you do it again soon.
Here's a good email from Clara. She says, my cousin who lives in a super liberal part of Massachusetts told another family member at a 4th of July parade, we don't teach our kids to support Republicans. To which my other family member, with grace, said, well, we teach our kids to support everyone. Says Clara, ouch. Growing up in a southern state, I had to learn how to get along with everyone. Maybe folks from Mass need to head down south for a little while.
Well, you know, we northerners, the northeasterners in particular, we believe the most intolerant people in the country are where?
In the South.
The South,
yeah,
of course.
That's right.
And so maybe we should be looking in the mirror.
I went to a wedding in Memphis. I was in Memphis for 4 days.
Yeah, that was,
I thought my head was going to pop off.
Yeah.
I mean, I just, by the end of the ceremony, there were only three people in the entire place I could talk to.
You know, and we, do you remember, I mentioned this before, I wasn't exaggerating. We had a woman who was a regular caller in the pre-Trump era. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, she almost always mentioned her fiancé. I don't know why. You know, my fiancé thinks this.
Well, yeah.
You remember shortly after, not long after Trump was elected, and I said to her, you haven't mentioned your fiancé today. You always do. What's up? What was her answer?
They broke up.
We're not together anymore because
He
supported Trump and I supported. Again, this makes sense. It's the most partisan time I can remember in my adulthood. But the fact that it's this bad is, you know, it's
and the other thing
explainable
I think,
but troubling, I guess.
The
I'm
other
saying.
Thing I think is true is that there are so few Republicans in Massachusetts. I mean, there are, as the Worcester caller said, there are a lot more people outside of Boston. You go down the Cape, you see a lot of Republicans there. But kind of around here, I mean, I've always told you the joke about how in Brookline, which is like uber left, like Cambridge, uber left, that when they have the school elections, you know, the little third graders, you'd be afraid to raise your hand to say you're voting for Mitt Romney because the entire class is on the other side sort of thing.
Didn't you tell the story? I mean, I think
Eric
we said
Fernstrom.
It out loud. Eric Fernstrom used to work at the Herald, worked for Mitt Romney.
Right.
When he was running for president, didn't his kid get harassed?
I don't know that he was harassed, but he had a difficult time in high school when people found out.
Because his father worked for Romney.
Exactly.
I mean,
So
that's a problem. Would you not agree?
Yes,
that's a real problem.
I would say that's a real problem.
You want to be
it's
angry
like
at the father.
You hear about Barron Trump, but
I know,
which is terrible, or anybody, or that other little boy that came to the State of the Union, whose last name was Trump, who was harassed in school. I mean, you hate to hear that kind of stuff.
Well, the only good news for Barron is his father seems to have forgotten him, so it doesn't. So obviously, it won't be that bad for him. Liz in North Attleboro, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Hi.
Hi guys, how are you?
We're good. Thanks for calling.
Long time listener, first time caller.
Whoa, great.
Yeah. This whole Trump administration is throwing me for a loop because my husband is a Trump supporter, and my best friend is a Trump supporter, and I am not.
How's that going?
Let's just say it's kind of difficult because every negative thing that comes out of this presidency, the two people that I speak to the most don't want to hear my feelings about it.
Oh boy!
So it's been rough. But,
so how do you, Liz?
I feel myself getting,
How do you deal with it? I mean, that is really hard.
It's hard because I remember the day. You know, the election results came out, and as silly as I feel, I cried my eyes out. Mm. And when I'm in that vulnerable emotional state, you know, like I said, the two people that I lean on had no sympathy for me. They were happy. They were celebrating. And it's crazy because, you know, my husband's a blue collar worker. He's a plumber just starting out on his own. And my best friend is, you know, lower middle class. And, you know, when I try to talk to them about, you know, what's going on in the country, it just starts to escalate and get into a fight. So I just can't even.
So do you retreat? Have you decided? I mean, we've had callers not unlike you, even though I can't remember whose spouse and best friend were on the other side, and you're on the other side from them, obviously. Do you consciously now not even bring up these things to avoid the
Absolutely.
Discomfort? Well, that is horrible.
Absolutely, because I know me and my friend made a pact, like we can't talk about politics because we just get angry. And, you know, I don't know where my husband's opinions came from because they both have very liberal outlooks on life. And I hate to categorize them like that, but, you know, pro-choice, you know, pro-gay marriage, everything under the, you know, everything under the liberal agenda.
So how do they support a guy who doesn't agree with those?
Tell your husband that the Trump administration is going to get rid of birth control soon. So, Liz, you may have to plan ahead for that one if he's in favor of that.
Well, you know what? We've got our two and we're all set. So that is a good conversation that needs to come up.
Hey, Liz, we're really glad you made your first call, too. Thanks. That was a great one.
Listen to this from Michael.
Good luck with your husband and friend.
I live in Massachusetts, but I'm from Columbus, Ohio. I'm a Democrat, but people here are much more firm in their political opinions and much more quick to criticize others with different views.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting one. And here's a theory.
Well, Ohio is also a state that is divided like by a thread. I mean, it is, as we know, it decides presidential elections, and it's always pretty close.
Keelan says, reasons for partisanship in Massachusetts, he blames the New England Patriots. Everyone's too used to winning. Treat politics as if it's sports, win and boast. That's an interesting theory.
Well, yeah, speaking of the Patriots, remember the whole brouhaha that went on for years, and I don't think is over, about the MAGA hat in Tom Brady's locker several years ago. Remember that?
Where he ultimately stopped answering
questions, didn't go to the White House. People like you think he didn't go to the White House because his wife told him not to go to the White House or should be aggravated with him. But it's just it infects every single thing we do and see.
One of our strongest supporters, Kevin, who always emails but never calls, thinks this whole conversation is hilarious. He's a big Trump guy. He says, did I ever stop talking or dealing with a friend who supported Obama? No. Why would I let that in the way get in the way of friendship? So he sees it very differently. Woman who just called from Worcester shows the poll is correct. Most of mass are leaning left and many are intolerant. But there are some few who aren't.
By the way, you should, this will make Kevin happy. In the Globe reporting on this study, or whatever you want to call it, study, on the whole, Democrats in Massachusetts were considerably more prejudiced against Republicans than elsewhere. So we're worse here than practically any place.
Yeah.
And Republicans in Massachusetts hold a similar distaste towards Democrats, except in Suffolk County, where members of the GOP are significantly less prejudiced towards Democrats than their counterparts.
Although, again,
elsewhere.
Mitt Romney, Charlie Baker, Paul Cellucci, Jane Swift, well, she wasn't elected, she was appointed.
Bill Weld.
I mean, we have had extremely popular.
Coolidge.
Yes. So
was Calvin Coolidge a governor of Massachusetts?
A lot of people.
Yeah.
We're out of time.
We are.
Oh, that's terrible.
Great.
I was just getting started.
I'm more tolerant than Marjorie. Who would have ever, ever thunk it?
Okay, coming up, what's next? We're talking to Art Kaplan. Listen to this one. Life after death. We're going to talk about that with Art Kaplan up next.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan. In this year's State of the Union address, President Trump vowed to end the HIV epidemic in the U.S. by 2030. Yesterday, he tweeted this, HIV is cured in second patient, doctor's report. Such great news for so many, tremendous progress being made. But is this great news that needs to be tempered by a whole lot of reality? Is this more of a breakthrough of how scientists pursue a cure for HIV rather than a breakthrough for the average person who has it? Joining us for his take on this and other medical headlines is Art Kaplan, Arts at Drs. William F. and Virginia Connolly Mini Chair, and director of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He's also the co-host of the Everyday Ethics Podcast, Art Kaplan.
Hello, hello.
And to you.
So, Art Kaplan, tell me something. It sounded to me that these patients who were cured of HIV were cancer patients who got bone marrow transplants, and it was almost by accident? It was kind of like, wow?
Not by accident, but it wasn't the goal. So they knew they might get a reward. What happened was this person had cancer, very bad cancer, and they treat that in part by doing bone marrow transplant. Bone marrow transplant isn't really a viable treatment for AIDS. It's horrible. It has side effects. You wouldn't be doing bone marrow transplants on patients. And the reason that this seemed to affect a cure, we'll come back to that in a minute, is that the person who supplied the bone marrow had genes, genetic makeup, where they had more resistance to HIV virus than the person who received the bone marrow. So in a way, they moved genes from the donor that were capable of resisting HIV virus better and got them into the patient a little bit by accident. it's hard to predict who has those genes. That's why I said you can't really run around doing bone marrow transplants all day. And a lot of people would die from them. They're awful to have to go through. And it isn't even clear that this guy's cured. I mean, right now there's no virus detectable, but it doesn't mean it's not hiding somewhere in his body and won't come back. So with respect to the president and the declaration that we've got a cure for AIDS, we don't. We, however, did learn that there are some people out there who seem more resistant to HIV. Maybe Magic Johnson is one of them. There are occasional survivors who seem to be going long-term, even though they're using drugs without detecting HIV. There's something in people's genes that makes some of them resistant. And by the way, Marjorie, you're going to love this. Remember our friend in China who did that weird gene editing experiment?
Oh, sure.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
He was trying to create this resistance. That's what he was doing. The parents of the embryo had HIV. He said, maybe I can engineer in the gene and do what this bone marrow transplant did. They're not unrelated, and they're both still way off in the future in terms of being able to use them as a cure. So interesting science, but no, it's not like there's a cure on the shelf now.
You mentioned Magic Johnson, the famed basketball NBA star. You said he's doing well because he's just, I mean, why did you mention him?
I think he may have this gene that gives a little bit more resistant to HIV and lets you live longer. And some people do. You know, there's a tiny percentage of people. It's always been a little mysterious why are they living longer when everybody else would die. And I think it's because they have this, you know, we all of us have this, whether it's the plague, not everybody was killed by the plague. Some people had genetic resistance that let them live through that. HIV has that. Some people don't get as sick from the flu as other people. There's clearly genetic stuff going on, and I think that's what's happening.
Okay.
So yesterday, Art Kaplan, when I heard that the head of the FDA, Scott Gottlieb, and we've spoken about him from time to time with you, had resigned, I immediately went, what I always do when any high-ranking federal official resigns, is I go to Donald Trump's Twitter feed to see what horrible thing the president is going to say about him. And Donald Trump praised Scott Gottlieb. So what does Art Kaplan say? What do we make of his tenure? I mean, I loved him on cigarettes and e-cigarettes and that sort of stuff.
Is this the first person to leave the administration without getting blasted by Donald
Trump? Well, that's
Trump,
what I thought. And so it raises, you know, didn't we talk to you a couple of weeks ago? Didn't the FDA approve that drug that was 10 times more powerful than fentanyl a couple of weeks ago? So what is it a mixed bag with Gottlieb? What's the deal?
I don't understand that decision, but I wouldn't even go so far as to say it's a mixed bag. He's been good. He's been a very good leader. He went after the opioid industry and did what the FDA hadn't been aggressive about doing before and trying to hold them accountable for this epidemic of overdose deaths that we see and misuse and abuse of painkillers. He has just started a campaign against vaping. And, you know, there's an upside. Some people do use vaping as a way to get off cigarettes, but there's a downside. A lot of kids use it as a gateway, and they wind up then moving on to cigarettes. So he had the data, and he was blunt and went right there and said, you know, this is a mixed situation. We got to protect the kids. And I think he's been pretty good and was gearing up to go after tobacco. He had a plan to start to regulate it more intensively. So on public health, he stood tall. I was hesitant about him when he first went into this position because he had a background more in industry. And I was like, I don't know. But he's been fine. He's done a good job. He's navigated politically tough waters. And I'm really sorry to see him go. So the question, obviously, is why is he going?
Well, he said he wanted to spend more time with his family, which I assume means he's being indicted next week. Is that not is that not usually what you say when you're about to be the cops?
It's either that or with politicians. Which family? Which family does he want to spend more time with? But I'm going to speculate, and I hope I'm wrong. I really hope I'm wrong, but maybe there's a health issue.
Oh, I hope you're wrong, too.
Oh, he's a young guy. I think he's like 46 or something like that.
Yeah, but remember, it's known he had cancer.
Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, goodness. That's too bad. Well, let's hope that's not it.
I hope I'm wrong. This is raw speculation. I don't mean to, you know, stir up something that's personal and private for him. He didn't say anything about it. But anyway.
Well, you did already, so it's okay.
It doesn't make sense to me otherwise because he's doing fine and no one's yelling at him to, you know, calm down or stop promoting hoaxes or there's no collusion or, you know, he's been able to navigate and get the job done. So it's a big loss. And I think the momentum on those campaigns is going to be set back. You know, even if the next person says, I'm for all these things, it's going to take a while to find them, get them approved, get them in there, get them oriented. You know, it's a setback. It really is.
Yeah. And this A.B. Abernathy, the physician and researcher, she's only a temporary. She's his deputy, but she's only a temporary until they find
You know,
a...
she just arrived. She just got there, I don't know, 3 months ago? She was at Duke. I know her. And she's fine. She's good. But she literally is finding her way around the agency, too, I'm sure.
Well, I think Kellyanne Conway will do a fine job running it. So
but what about the guy that does the budget? The guy that does the budget? He's doing
Mick Mulvaney. No, he's in charge of everything.
He's got several jobs now, so maybe he could do the FDA as well.
The obvious.
Jared Kushner.
Yeah.
Okay, fine. Enough of this.
Javonka.
Okay. So, Art Kaplan, we've learned that Purdue, and they're, of course, the company that manufactured OxyContin, and is owned by the Sackler family, which and their family has their names all over all sorts of buildings all over the place here and elsewhere. They're exploring bankruptcy. Is this a good thing, bad thing?
You know, it's tricky. I think the fact that there are so many lawsuits and they're being held to account, that may push them into this bankruptcy mode. And, you know, I think I'm not against that. But sometimes you go to bankruptcy to avoid liability, right? So everybody's suing you and they want money for the cost of the opioid epidemic and the state's governments are after you and insurance companies are after you. And so you go bankrupt and then try to figure out another way to come back to life. The ethics of bankruptcy are tricky. Sometimes you use it to avoid being held accountable. And I don't know enough about this one to know for sure, but I'm watching because that company has been, to be blunt, so sleazy that I worry that they're kind of saying, okay, you all want to sue us, then we'll go bankrupt.
You know, but there's one interest that, as you know, Maura Healey, the attorney general from Massachusetts, is on our show every month, and she's one of the lawyers who's not just on behalf of the state, obviously, suing Purdue, but the Sackler family individually.
Yep.
And at least from my preliminary reading of these stories about bankruptcy, bankruptcy may insulate the company, even though it's privately held, meaning not a publicly traded corporation, from some liability in these hundreds, thousands of lawsuits, whatever they are. I don't think in any way it protects the individuals if they are found liable, as Maura Healey suggests they are. So we'll talk to her about it whenever she's back with us in the next couple of weeks.
You know what you got to ask her? So let's say the family's rich and we can go after them, but let's say they're rich because they own stock in the company. If that goes bankrupt and the stock goes worthless, what's there?
Well, that's an interesting question.
Yeah.
We will bring it up, and we'll bring it up back with you. So, Art, can we move to my young hero?
He is great.
Here is a clip from high school student Ethan Lindenberger, even though if you saw him testify, it looks like he's 40. That may be a problem, but he does.
But you know what, you know what I loved about him?
What?
He's obviously opposed to his mother on this vaccination stuff, but he's very gentle about it.
No, he was. Here it is. Well, here's a little bit of the testimony first. The Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions, and he's talking about combating misinformation about vaccines.
I approached my mother numerous times trying to explain that vaccines are safe and that my family should be vaccinated, approaching even with articles from the CDC explicitly claiming that ideas that vaccines cause autism and extremely dangerous consequences were incorrect. In one such instance where I approached my mother with information from the CDC that claimed vaccines do not cause autism, she responded with, "That's what they want you to think." Skepticism and worry were taking the forefront in terms of information.
You know what I wasn't clear about here, Art, and it's probably because I didn't read enough. I'm not clear if it's just the hearing about the public education aspect of the vaccines and all the BS that comes from the anti-vaxxer myths, or is there a federal proposal to do what we've talked to you about, is to eliminate all exemptions except medical exemptions? Which, do you know which it is?
It's the former.
Former,
so
just an information.
Federal government gets out information, is watching the role of social media in promoting misinformation.
Uh-huh.
I think you know that I've been arguing about this and had a little success. Some of the social media sites are starting to back away from promoting anti-vax sites. You know, it used to be if you did a Google search, the first 111 things that came up were anti-vaccine sites before you got to the CDC thing. So that's the federal government's role. States control the exemptions. So Massachusetts legislature would have to get rid of its religious exemption, or New York, or whatever. It's a state issue there. So they don't, I mean, they could be encouraging of that in Congress, but they're not able to do anything about it. It's states that set policies about school vaccination. I want to meet this kid. I mean, I would love to be there for that dinner conversation where he comes and says, you know, Mom, you're kind of an idiot. I got real data here, and you're telling me that, you know, Joel Featherwexer Blatherer says that vaccines cause autism, and why are you reading that stuff? You know, it must have been interesting, but good for him. He's on the right track, and, you know, when you get an identified young person saying, I want to be protected, I want my rights honored to be protected from diseases, that really makes a difference. It's one thing for me to say this whole vaccine thing shouldn't just be about parents and what they get to choose and exemptions. Who's speaking up for the young people and their rights? They have rights too, right? We say things like you got to wear a bike helmet.
Exactly.
And wouldn't care if parents said, I don't want to do that. And we say, you got to put your kid in a car seat. And I'm sure some parent is out there saying, well, I don't want to do that. We don't care. And why don't we care? Because kids have a right to health too. And so this young man, whose name I'm forgetting.
Ethan Lindeberger.
Yeah.
Lindeberger, yeah. Really spoke up for that group. And you know, you can see him and hear him. And I think that's going to sway the debate. I think he will have a very positive impact, particularly on efforts to clean up the internet and get the sort of trash and misinformation out of there, or at least not promote it so heavily and not just say, well, it's not our problem, it's free speech, you can put anything you want up there, and we don't care.
You know, Art, there are two things I don't understand about this whole vaccine thing, because obviously the evidence is overwhelming that vaccines prevent these terrible diseases, and you have to have enough people vaccinated for that herd immunity, whatever they call it. Number one, why we can't treat this like we do car seats? This is a child protection. You're not entitled to put your child in danger. Why, the same rules that would apply to like the Christian Scientists or something that don't get their kids' appendix out or whatever, it doesn't apply to vaccines. And second, why the schools can't forbid unvaccinated children from coming in? I know in Massachusetts you have to present your vaccination list before your child is in kindergarten. Why they can't just say you can't come?
They should, and they should enforce it. And by the way, daycare too. A couple of states, I've worked with them in Rhode Island and in Connecticut to make sure you can't go to daycare unless you get your vaccines. That's another hotbed area to spread not only vaccines to other kids, diseases to other kids, but also you bring them home, right? I mean, who isn't got a kid in the house who's in daycare is not getting all kinds of colds and infections, because that's like a incubator there.
It is, like an incubator.
So the answer is we should be treating this exactly the same as the car seats, the bike helmets, and seat belts, which is to say they are known to work. They protect kids who can't choose for themselves. They protect against very real harms of death and disability. You know, people say, well, they're not 100% safe vaccines. I hate to tell you this, but a seatbelt isn't 100% safe. Every once in a while, somebody gets stuck in a car because they got a seatbelt on and they can't get out if they fell in a lake or something. And it's a one in a million. But it doesn't make us say, well, then, okay, you don't have to wear a seatbelt. The information, the odds, the risk-benefit are so in the favor of seatbelts, or for that matter, the exploding safety bags, that even though there are occasional recalls and stuff, we don't change policy, and that's what vaccines are. So, yes, you're right. We ought to treat it that way, and I'll say it again. The only exemption a state should have, Massachusetts, Vermont, Connecticut, to childhood vaccination is if your kid has a health reason, egg allergy, or they got a disease and they don't have any immune system, so there's no point in vaccinating them. That's it. No exemptions.
By the way, I don't want to move on. I do want to move on, but there's one prominent doctor who made clear during the hearing he opposes mandatory vaccinations. Dr. Rand Paul, which, as far as I don't even know how you're allowed to be a doctor if you take that position.
Well, he's a libertarian.
By the way, that's not a joke. I think another thing to start looking at is if the standard of care among pediatricians is to get kids vaccinated, then doctors who say they don't do that or won't do that, shouldn't they come up and get their license challenged?
Yes.
Well, he, in defense of him, he says he vaccinates his kids and recommends it. He's just, as Marjorie says, this BS libertarian thing, which I'm fine with on many issues, not fine with on public health issues. In any case, so Art, this young man, Peter Zhu, Z-H-U, dies. He's a star student at West Point. He dies in an accident at 21 years old. His parents say that he had been saying in his young life how much he wanted to have children. He didn't have any yet. That he wanted, in fact, to have five, live on a ranch, have a horse. So they engage in something I had never heard of before, which totally gives me the creeps, both personally and ethically, even though you're the ethicist. It's called postmortem sperm retrieval. Could you explain what's going on there and explain whether you have concerns about even doing this?
You're going to love this because I think I had the first case of this ever to happen.
Really?
I was back at the University of Pennsylvania. The year's 1997. We had been talking at a Grand Rounds about the idea that even though a man dies, you could still surgically remove sperm from him after his death or use electrical stimulation and get sperm. So there are ways to do it. Nobody knew how long the sperm would be active. Could you do it 48 hours after death, 72 hours, a week? Nobody knew, but it was something that people were kicking around. So I talked about it on a radio interview kind of like this. Next day, a man is out in the backyard with his wife having a barbecue, a young guy, and has a stroke and drops dead. The woman had heard my interview. They take him into the hospital, and she says, "I want his sperm." So the hospital had never heard of it either. They're like, "What is this?" And she said, "Well, I heard some guy babbling on about someday maybe we could take sperm or eggs, for that matter, out of deceased people and try to have a baby." So they brought this body to Penn, and on the spot, we made up a bunch of rules. You'll love this. We said, "Do you have any proof that this man was trying to have a baby with you?" And she brought two sisters in, and they said, yes, they were trying to have a child. So we said, all right, I guess maybe he wanted one with her, the wife. She is the wife, so she knows his wishes and so forth. Maybe we'll take the sperm, but maybe we should have, I thought, a waiting period after grief and the shock of all this. So we said, you can't use it if we take it for 6 months. You got to wait. She agreed, and we took it. 6 months later, she came in and said, "I've decided I don't want to use it." So that was the first case. You had a waiting period. Issues came up about who could request it. This young guy who died, the West Point cadet, he doesn't have a wife. Mm-hmm. When the issue comes up about could we take sperm from him, and it's going to have to happen in the next day or two, I'm pretty sure. Otherwise, I don't think the sperm will be viable. But who's going to use it? A surrogate?
Yeah.
A girlfriend?
Yeah.
His sister? I don't know if he's got a – but who? You know, so to me, that becomes – less likely to be something I would honor because there's no one he was planning to have a child with before he died. And as long as I'm going on and on about this, you know that we fill out when we get our driver's license, you register as an organ donor, right?
Yeah.
You guys have had that.
Yep.
So you say, I want to donate my liver and my kidney. Maybe we should add to that thing sperm and eggs and uterus because they're doable now. And then we'd have your wishes. You could say, I don't want to do that, or I do want to do that. I think it's time to revisit what's called the Uniform Anatomical Gift Act, which is a state issue, again, not a federal, and see if we're going to add this kind of a condition. And the military could do it, too. If I'm going to deploy to Afghanistan, maybe somebody should ask me to fill out a form if I die there.
By the way, very quickly, when you said who could use it, so-and-so, you didn't, when you said his sister, you didn't mean his sister could.
Oh, I did.
You did?
I mean, people volunteer all kinds of people to carry that baby.
Isn't that against the law?
Yeah, his brother's sperm?
Right. So what would happen is you'd use a donor egg, not hers.
Okay. So, Art, before you go, we're going to talk to our listeners about this. Like, I'm a little embarrassed by this whole story, but I figured I'd ask you about it. I read a story this morning on, I think it was health.com or something, explaining, even though I had no understanding of what the explanation is why people, otherwise known as me, feel faint when they see blood. You know, let me just say, I'm going to say this later, but I'll say to you quickly, I think you can appreciate this. Whenever I have my blood taken, the phlebotomist is what they're called.
I think so.
I am so pathetic that, first of all, I'm 6'5". I'm not a kid. At the end, almost every time, the phlebotomist says, oh, Mr. Browdy, you're such a fine patient. Yeah. You're, and like literally patting me on the head and giving me a lollipop. It's so humiliating. So why do I feel... I really do get faint feeling, not seeing it. Well, seeing it too, seeing it, having it taken. What's that about? What's the science?
And by the way, just to tie it to our topic of today, vaccines, people get that feeling when they just see the needle. Many people get queasy.
So what is
one of the problems about vaccination? So scientists have found that really there's a fight or flight response when we're facing danger, if you will, but there's also a faint response that you literally just collapse in the face of danger. It's almost like those animals we see playing dead, and it's built into us. It's wired into us. It's like some people have it stronger than others, but it's kind of a reflex to avoid danger. So you used to think you were just a weenie. Now you can say you're just a product of evolution.
So one last thing about this. Can people train themselves out of it? I mean, I've been this way since I was a kid. If I had said when I was six years old and squeamish, I want to be a doctor.
Yeah.
So you can?
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those classic conditioning things like they use for phobias. You're afraid of flight. You sort of do, you know, you get in a plane, you sit there, and then they rev it up and go down the runway, but they don't take, you know, it's that kind of thing. You can. So I'm not going to say it works for everybody, but it'll help some people.
So you explain what happens when you feel faint, when you see blood. What is the explanation when you feel faint when you're talking about seeing blood, which I'm forget that. Okay. I am pathetic. What's the Everyday Ethics Podcast, Art Kaplan?
We're looking at the weird case of Jesse Smollett and trying to figure out what do we do when somebody basically lies and seeks our sympathy. Why do they do that? Do we forgive them? Do we say they're sick or ill or mentally disturbed? Or are they manipulating us? How do you handle those cases? Mm. He's not the only one. There have been many others, but he's just the more recent one.
You know what's amazing? In the age of Trump, Jesse Smollett is so in the rearview mirror now, even though he shouldn't be. Yeah, I'm so glad you're doing that. We'll be listening. Art, it's great to talk to you. Thanks.
Thanks, guys.
Okay, Art Kaplan joins us every week. He's the Dr. William F. and Virginia Conley Committee Chair and Director of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU Langone Medical Center and the co-host of the Everyday Ethics Podcast. Coming up, is the arrest of Bob Kraft a turning point for how we look at who's guilty and who's the victim when it comes to the illegal sex trade in Boston? The Boston Globe's Shirley Leung joins us for that and more next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
At noon on Boston Public Radio, in a hard-fought primary to represent the state's 3rd Congressional District, Lori Trahan won by a narrow margin, but did a last-minute injection of money, $400,000 worth, help her victory? The Boston Globe is asking, where did the money come from and was it legal? We'll talk to Shirley Leung about this and more. And then a new initiative is working to get gang members off the corner and onto the college campus. We'll talk to the duo behind College Bound Dorchester about the support system it takes to get these young men and women on the academic track.
Under a landmark settlement, hundreds of severely mentally ill New York City residents were moved out of institutions and into private apartments. A new Frontline documentary investigates what happened to them after they got their independence and how the government failed to prepare them for it. How fast is one of the largest glaciers melting? The world's Carolyn Beeler joins us from Antarctica with an update. That's next on Boston Public Radio.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
Eastern Brady. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. This is hour number two. Hello, yes. Jim.
Hello, Marjorie. So 2 weeks before the September primary, Democratic candidate Lori Trahan was in fourth place in polling in the race that replaced Nikki Tsongas in Congress. It's the third congressional district. But then she got an injection of nearly $400,000, a cash boost that might have helped her eke out a win. Now the Boston Globe, through Andrea Estes, is asking where that money came from, and the rest of us are asking if she broke the rules, will have to resign or pay a hefty fine, or none of the above. Joining us to talk about this and other headlines is Shirley Leung. Shirley, of course, is the Boston Globe's interim editorial page editor and a GBH contributor. Hi, Shirley.
Hi. Hi. Well, let's start with Lori Trahan. She, many newspapers, I think including the Globe, editorialized for her election.
Thought
she
was a
terrific candidate. Got endorsed by, I think, almost every paper.
Yeah, so obviously a very impressive candidate. But, I mean, to me, this whole situation with the last-minute infusion of funds catapulted her from fourth place to first place and doesn't seem quite kosher.
I mean, I think right now, I mean, we looked into this. We were thinking about doing an editorial. We're still thinking about it. As I understand it, the story was based on what's been filed publicly so far, and I think it's just through May of 2018. There still needs to be another disclosure that's supposed to come out in May of this year that will cover the second half. And I think Trahan is trying to explain, listen, and I don't, those documents aren't publicly available right now.
Them publicly available.
Right. I think we've seen some, we haven't seen what she's going to disclose in May, but we do have some documents showing that, in 2018, this is how much her company, I guess it gives a fuller picture of how much money she came from her consulting business. I mean, we haven't dug deeper into it, but I think that I'm hoping that she will step forward and explain a little more fully how she funded, where that last infusion of money came from. I mean, when you look at her finances.
By the way, the suggestion Andreas's piece was that in violation of law, it's not her own money, which is legal. You can give yourself or lend yourself as much as you want. That in fact, the suggestion is it might be coming from her husband. Who has tons of dough and tons of businesses,
right,
which would technically be in violation of law. And the Globe story that Andrea wrote said, generally, it's just a fine. But if the conclusion is the illegal campaign finance activity, if there is illegal campaign finance activity, help determine the outcome, and going from fourth to first in 2 weeks is a pretty big deal, then there might even be a criminal prosecution. But again, she says she's guilty of nothing.
Yeah, I think what she needs to do, I mean, again, she's a first-time elected official, and you know, what we were thinking of is like we'd like to hear from her directly on what happened. I don't think there's been a full explanation of her business and it's been couched as a very successful consulting business. And so one would think that she would have money. Also, she has they have two homes, I believe, and they only took a home equity loan of $71,000. And I was thinking they probably could have taken more. So anyways, I think she needs to explain more about what exactly happened.
She put out a statement, I'm sure you have it too, at the Globe, saying this is from her communications person. Any suggestion that Representative Trahan did not have the financial resources to personally contribute to her campaign is completely inaccurate. They go through some of these things. She accurately reported $371,000 personal contribution to her campaign. It came from the following. And by the way, she would not give an interview to Andrea Estes, which is concerning. Andrea also asked for copies of her bank records.
Yes.
They wouldn't share those. If you did nothing wrong, and they contend pretty strongly they did not, the answer, at least in my estimation, is you pack up everything in the box, say to Andrea Estes, when can you meet? And you provide all the documentation rather than doing summary. I've only met her once. I was really impressed by her, by the way. And one of the things I was impressed by in her campaign, and Andrea mentions this, before I had met her, is she kept talking about transparency.
Yes,
I'm a big transparency guy. I know you guys are. And so if you're a big transparency person, then be transparent. And maybe this whole thing that what Andrea reported could be accurate, and what Trahan is saying, because she failed to disclose things that she should have, could also be accurate. as a result of her failure to do disclosure. And she amended her disclosures four times, Andrea reports. So get with it. I mean, get the information out
there. Yeah, I agree. I think she needs to come out and talk about it. I do think that there's more disclosures coming, but right now she's in under the spotlight and she's
well, obviously, when you say
now.
You think there's more coming, obviously they've told you that. You don't have to say that, but it's pretty obvious they have. And the answer is just do it. And by the way, we've invited her. I've invited her on Greater Boston, and they say that she very much wants to do it. And just scheduling issue, obviously, with the traveling, and we're hoping next week we'll have her on. And I do hope that she can explain that this is perfectly legal. We're talking to Shirley Leung, interim editorial page editor of the Boston Globe.
So, Shirley Leung, you had a very interesting op-ed about Bob Kraft and his travails with the massage parlor down in Florida. I believe it was Swanee Hunt.
Yeah.
Yes. Wrote former it. Ambassador.
What was her argument?
And, well, she was saying that, as I understand it, Swanee has been very involved in anti-human trafficking efforts. And she basically thanked Bob Kraft. She said that at the end. She said, listen, this is an issue that hasn't gotten enough attention. And because of Bob Kraft's, it's become front and center for a lot of law enforcement and for people realizing that there are illicit massage parlors that are really modern-day brothels acting in plain sight at storefronts and strip malls like this one in Florida where Bob Kraft allegedly frequented.
She's right, isn't she?
She
How much
is right.
We know?
Well, she is right that everybody is now learning more about these women because some people think that prostitution it's consensual, right? And this Swanee's point is that listen, this case shows that it's not consensual. It's sex slavery. These women, a lot of these women are brought over from overseas. In this case, from China, brought in perhaps to work legitimately at a spa, but instead were basically imprisoned in these storefront spas where they would eat and sleep and not leave the premises unless supervised.
You know, we said at the time, I don't know if it was with you or without you, Shirley, last week when the story broke. I've met Kraft maybe two times in my whole life, but I have to say I admire him in a lot of ways. And what I think Marjorie and I talked about was the only way to deal with this is to make a public statement, not your first statement, which says I won't comment anymore because there's litigation, but saying, assuming it's true, obviously you shouldn't say you did something you didn't do, but the evidence, at least so far, seems pretty overwhelming. I did it. I'm ashamed. I'll never do it again. I'm going to try to make amends for this. I have my whole life. I'll try, et cetera. But then he hires Jeffrey Epstein's lawyer. And I think Jeffrey Epstein, it's hard to say who is the most disgusting serial pedophile rapist in America. You know, R. Kelly's doing his interviews this morning.
Jim.
But I have to say, Jeffrey Epstein, with the help of the former U.S. attorney who's now Secretary of Labor for the United States of America, got off scot-free. He's hired Jeffrey Epstein's lawyer. We read this morning in the New York Times, his second lawyer is William Burke, B-U-R-C-K, who was a lawyer in the George W. Bush White House. This does not sound like a...
He's not going quietly, and that public statement is not happening. I mean, he is going to try to get the charges dismissed. I mean, as the New York Times story pointed out, Kraft has a lot on the line as it relates to the NFL,
yeah,
his ownership of the team, and also, you know, the Patriot Way. It's the whole brand of a key part of the brand of the New England Patriots that they're squeaky clean, they're above board.
Just total BS. They bring in criminals who have done horrible things, and then the line is, well, I'll tell you, the greatest coach of all time, which he may be, Bill Belichick, is able to get, you know, bad behaving kinds of guys to behave. So since Myra Kraft died, this is not disrespectful to her husband, this has not been like when she said we got to undraft whatever his name
Christian Peter. But you know what I didn't
who
realize?
Was that? By the way, it was a guy from Nebraska who had committed.
I think he beat up his girlfriend or something like that.
They
she said we're not
going to
get any violent girlfriend beaters on our team, and he didn't make the team. But what I didn't realize again until I talked to Trani Kuznarek from NBC Sports, she's an anchor there, yesterday, is that Kraft has been very important to the NFL too. He's managed to negotiate.
Yes, he's one of the most powerful. He's probably the most powerful NFL team owner.
Yes, and very tough with the people that he has to deal with in terms of TV rights and all those things
exactly.
and getting great.
Yes.
So they're in an interesting position with him as well. I mean, and what does the NFL do?
Right. And basically, Roger Goodell, I mean, he works for the owners, right? Mm-hmm. So he has to decide a punishment for basically one of his bosses.
Can I explain one thing I said a minute ago? If Kraft really believes he is innocent, then I am totally for him fighting. I'm just saying, as an objective person looking at the objective evidence
with the videotape.
However, well, we haven't seen the videotape.
We know it exists.
Right. But the other side is, even if you are innocent and plan to fight the charges, hiring the lawyer for one of the most disgusting creatures on the planet, Jeffrey Epstein, is not a good start in my estimation.
I think unless he is completely innocent and that was not Mr. Kraft, as we call him, in the videotape, and he was not there and there was some case of mistaken identity, fighting the charges will hurt the Patriots tremendously.
Yes.
I think.
I agree with that.
Well, I think if you're looking for the way to – if you're a PR person and you're looking for the way to get out of this, I think you were right when you said weeks ago – a complete mea culpa. I didn't understand. Now I understand. My regret is 150%. I'm going to put some of my dollars toward making this. I mean, doing a full throttle confession.
Or if he did, let's assume, or do a full throttle defense.
Well, if he didn't do it.
Yes, I was at the parlor. I got a massage. Right. It is untrue. There was no money for sex or whatever it is that he's accused of. Having said that, a guy who's that high profile, who's done that many positive things, I think it's only in the community's benefit, but also to his, to not hide behind these lawyers, even though I know generally you listen to the lawyers unless you're Donald Trump.
Just as a side note, someone that everyone admired tremendously, at least in the Democratic Party, was Bill Clinton. He's going to be is still coming to Boston this spring with Hillary Clinton. He's gone down about a million pegs in this Me Too movement, and I think Kraft will get pushed into that.
Well, I should just say that what Bob Kraft, and not at all defending what he's accused of, Bob Kraft's worst crime is nowhere near what Bill Clinton is credibly accused of. Would you not agree? I mean, you believe that there are credible allegations of rape.
I do.
And I happen to, too. So, again, it's hard to...
Well, there's grades. We all know there's grades of sexual abuse and sexual harassment and sex crimes and this sort of thing. But, I mean, as Swanee Hunt pointed out in the piece, this is a really sleazy, horrible underworld that a lot of us didn't know about.
Right.
And I'm really glad, too, that the idea that prostitution is a victimless crime is being debated again, because I never bought that notion that any little girl wants to grow up and become a prostitute. Something happens along the way.
By the way, one of the, as I am an addict of 6 minutes of sports radio driving in every morning, the latest defense of Kraft is, even if there's human trafficking, the two women who were massaging him were the owners of the club. So as a result, they weren't human trafficking. I mean, it is so pathetic. I mean, you can't get away from the conditions. There's no dispute about the conditions that these women live under.
He's also not being accused of human trafficking.
Right, that's correct. That's correct.
Just prostitution.
We're talking to Shirley Leon. Shirley, you just published a piece from Andrea Campbell, who's a monthly guest of ours, and she is the president of the Boston City Council, talking about the search for the new superintendent. And she has some, I don't know if they're rules of the world, but at least recommendations to make sure we get the right person, that he or she is given the power to do the job. What's she saying?
If you read this piece, she's pretty hopped up. She's not very happy about the process. A colleague, Jamie Vasnes, wrote a piece earlier this week about how the search for a new superintendent is very slow going and not very transparent. And Andrea Campbell writes that she does not think it's been transparent. She wanted a city Council to be more involved. She says not only are parents in the dark or students in the dark, but she's in the dark, and she's the city council president, and she would like to see a more transparent process. I didn't realize this until reading her op-ed that she headed the headmaster search for Boston Latin.
Oh, maybe I did, yeah.
Latin, and so she said that was a very—
Where she went.
She's a product of Boston Public Schools, and so she said a transparent process is what we need here and get everybody involved. She talks about she wants to see a courageous leader, someone with relevant experience. I said relevant experience that she talks about. And also she wants whoever gets she wants the community to support, I guess, the next superintendent. She feels that the community she would like to see this when they go through candidates, they present their plan, their plans become public, and that the community can right off the bat embrace the plan and the person together. And so I thought it was a very compelling piece. She was very honest. You know, sometimes when politicians write, they can—
She's terrific.
Yeah, they can be a little wishy.
Marjorie thinks she was criticizing Mayor Walsh without using his name.
She was.
I was going to say this elected leader micromanaging the school department. Right. I assume that she meant Marty Walsh.
She, you know, sometimes politicians can be a little too diplomatic in op-eds.
Yep.
But she got straight to her points, and she also talked about making some tough decisions about, you know, she's saying the school budget is $1 billion and right now, and there's not enough going into the classroom, too much going into kind of structural needs.
But you know something? This part of it was contradictory, and we have her on a lot, and I'll ask her about this myself when I see her, because I do think she's a terrific, is that part of the reason they're in this outdated infrastructure is every time they try to close a school in Boston, and I understand why parents and kids go crazy. Nobody wants their school to close, but they get all these schools that are not anywhere near capacity that they're paying to bus children to, that they're paying to heat and light and have custodians and everything like that. So part of it, the transparency piece, having parent and kid involvement is great, but not when every time you try to do something, the parents and kids shut it down because they're upset. And that's what happened to Tommy Chang when we try to change school times, try to shut down these schools. And then when you talk about the transparency.
But can I interrupt you right there?
What?
The solution to what you're describing is not getting rid of input. The solution is getting input. And if you still think after the input as a leader that the right thing to do may be something that upsets the constituents, then you do what you think the right thing to do is.
Well, I think gets into the piece where she was talking about interference from Walsh. Now, I don't know what happened with these school shutdowns. Chang proposed it. It never happened.
They're in the process right now of looking at which schools should be shut down. I mean, one theory is that Laura Perel, who is the interim superintendent, I mean, she's going to make some tough decisions.
Because she's not going to be here.
Exactly.
Well, like the exam school thing, it's reported in your paper, changing the entrance
exam
potentially.
Right, exactly. She's doing some of tackling some of the thorniest issues so that when the new superintendent comes in, he or she does not have to deal with them.
But you know, can I say on the air without being, I think I can. We never said this on the air because we thought it was unfair because it was just our opinion based on, we first met Tommy Chang when he came in with Marty Walsh.
I was here. I think I was here when Tommy and Mayor Walsh came in.
And
he
hadn't taken over yet. I think he took over July 1st. Yeah. It was like June. I can tell what we thought, right? There's nothing wrong with this now. Marjorie and I, we were very anxious to meet him. Marjorie particularly is obsessed with education in the Boston Public Schools, and I admire that obsession, I should say. And we spent maybe an hour with him, or it was a long period of time. And when the show was over, we both said to each other how wildly unimpressed we were, and he seemed petrified. And I think the defense that I gave him, since we didn't know him except for that hour, was, well, he's in the presence of his new boss, he's a tough mayor, and so maybe it's just anxiety starting a new job. But I think we learned he wasn't strong enough for the job.
I would say he wasn't schooled in Boston politics, and that's what got him in trouble. And I think if you read Andrea's op-ed, she signals that you need someone who knows this community and knows how to work the community and understands our issues. And I remember when Laura Perel was brought in. I mean, she was brought in also not a very transparent process. Yeah. And she was just kind of installed right away and kind of out of kind of a surprise. And I was thinking it was very telling that BPS didn't have a bench. Normally, your interim would come within, mm-hmm. from within. And so I think it's very telling that they didn't have a bench. And so when you look ahead, like who could do this job, it's unlikely that person's going to probably be within BPS. But, there are a lot of BPS alums. So I think that's where the search committee should be looking. Are there accomplished BPS alums who can come back?
One of my most brilliant ideas, and it's hard to decide which is brilliant. I know. But I think you thought this one was pretty creative, is when Marty Walsh beat John Connolly. And John Connolly, his whole campaign was about the schools. Mm-hmm. I think I asked Walsh in the next meeting, John and the next Connolly. Time he was on the air, why don't you pick Connolly?
What did he say?
I think the mayor said he was open to it. And then I believe we either interviewed Connolly or emailed him a question. And I believe he said that he was open to it. And I actually thought it was going to happen, not because I suggested it.
I've been thinking about getting Connolly to write an op-ed for us. This was after. Actually, it was Marjorie, your suggestion, after the valedictorian, the Globe's valedictorian series.
Well, he was up to his eye teeth in the Boston schools. He's got three kids in the Boston schools, unless they've grown out of it now.
Didn't he teach for a while, too,
I don't know, but he was all about education. But people didn't like him. I mean, he wasn't as popular. People don't think he was as nice a guy as Marty Walsh. But one last thing about this.
I don't know if that's true. As Walsh got more votes, he ran a better campaign.
Well, that was the word.
The people didn't like him was the word.
He wasn't as personally popular.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, I think Walsh was pretty affable.
Yeah, but the other thing is about Andrea. And I'm not sure if she's saying this, but she talks a lot about transparency. And we've talked about this a million times. I think with you too, that if you're not going to hire from within, and you are never going to get a really quality superintendent. If everybody has to know who they are.
And Paul Revel, who's been on the former
Secretary of Education. She discusses it with
Revel all the time. Almost every month, right? But yeah, he has said, I think he's actually quoted in Jamie's story, that because the process has to be so public, you don't get the best candidates. But you
should explain the reason for that is when you get rejected, when you don't get the job, the people back home know you were trying to leave, which does not make you popular with your employer.
And some schools, some searches or public searches have moved to that where the finalist names are. I mean, it's a delicate balance though, right?
But it's almost self-defeating. I mean, imagine if you announced you were going to the National Public Radio Station out in San Francisco.
They've rejected every application I've sent them.
Mail. It might cause a little friction here in the studio. You know what I mean? I mean, the whole notion of it, and I get that people want to be involved, but then you say to yourself, how much can parents and kids know? I don't know about whom to pick.
Shirley, we only have a couple of minutes left.
Okay.
Can I bring up one other thing?
Yes.
I'm talking to a friend of mine over the weekend. That would be you. Meaning you. And what I didn't realize, I'm almost embarrassed, that part of your world that you're in charge of is the ideas section.
Oh, that's right.
The Globe.
Oh, and this is great.
And I have to say, in the last few weeks, I've actually always been a fan of ideas, but in the last few weeks, the Marcela Garcia thing about Roma was just
first-person
spectacular.
Essay. Yeah. Yeah.
And talk about a provoking public debate. This piece by S.I. Rosenbaum, A Shocking Number of Jews Have Become Willing Collaborators in White Supremacy, writing it off the Michael Cohen testimony, who says early in his testimony, I'm a kid. I'm a son of a Holocaust survivor. Well, I'll read the first sentence of the piece. This week, the son of a Holocaust survivor sat before Congress, testified about how he had helped install a white supremacist autocrat, in quotes, as president of the United States. And she makes the case, yet even as white nationalists wish us dead, a shocking number of Jews have become willing collaborators in white supremacy. Not only public bigots like Ben Shapiro and David Horowitz, but capos in the openly ethno-nationalist Trump regime, such as Stephen Miller and Jared Kushner. To say there's been blowback, and you printed a lot of it?
A lot of letters this morning, I believe.
And what's the basis for the criticism?
Well, that it's anti-Semitic, mm-hmm. and
the,
that
her position,
her
is
S.I. Rosenbaum is anti-Semitic, and S.I. is a regular contributor to the Ideas section, but that it's anti-Semitic, and that it was generalizing that all Jews are, like Michael Cohen, who wanted to assimilate so badly that they're mm-hmm. willing to promote the white supremacist ways of the Trump administration, and I think she's pretty careful of not generalizing and. But this piece actually started a couple weeks ago. It didn't actually start with Michael Cohen. There was something else that happened about liberal Jewish culture, and so she started working on it. And then when the Michael Cohen testimony dropped last Wednesday, and he talks about his father, a Holocaust survivor, then it became a story about Michael Cohen and white supremacy and how some Jews like Cohen. Who want to be accepted, do some things that they regret, and this is what the piece was about. And S.I., what's happened in the last couple of weeks? We're trying to reboot Ideas. We have a new editor, interim
Who's
editor
that?
Rachel Slade, who was a top editor at Boston Magazine.
She wrote some big book last year, didn't she?
She did a very critically acclaimed book about El Faro, the ship. I think Into the Raging Sea it was called. Anyways, we're trying to. Trying to provoke more conversation out of Ideas and the Ideas section. And guess what we have this Sunday?
What?
Can you be too old to be president? Is the right age?
Oh, fantastic.
I can answer the question. The answer is yes, you can.
Yes, yes. You'll be shockingly how young you have to be in order to be the right – what's the right age to be president?
Can I say one last thing about Rosenbaum's piece? I read almost all the letters that you printed today. And I think, if the piece had been narrowed to some of the Jewish Americans who were serving Donald Trump, I think her point was well taken. I do think when she says a shocking number, I think the people from some Jewish organizations in town have used your word that it's a generalization. The one thing I'm disappointed she did, and I hope I reread it this morning. I didn't miss it. The one guy who I think I would have mentioned is Gary Cohn.
He
didn't quit over Charlottesville, but he did quit over Texas.
I don't know about that, but Cohn's in there.
Okay,
Cohn's
sorry.
In there.
You know
what
she says at the end was, if Jews are going to survive the future, we will have to stand with people of color for our mutual benefit. And you're reminded, of course, about how many Jewish Americans were deeply involved in the civil rights movement in the United States and paid the ultimate price in some cases for that involvement. So I thought that was an interesting very interesting point that she made.
I mean, what I liked about, I think the reason why S.I.'s, this was one of the most popular stories
for days. Website,
for days. And same thing with Marcella's Roma piece. And if you look at both pieces back to back, what I loved about them is that they give you a window into a culture that we don't, or a way that we don't talk about it in America. Like Marcella's piece was about Mexican, she's Mexican American, and was Roma is a movie set in Mexico and about domestic help. And it was just about, it's just a side of Mexican culture.
Well, the Spaniards,
right,
treating the indigenous people horribly.
Right.
And I thought that was fascinating.
Right.
I didn't even know
right,
that.
She said that Mexicans are like, there's many, many, like hundreds, not thousands of, or, you know, whatever, different ethnicities, right? And same thing with, I think, SIs. It's like we don't talk about Jews this way in America. And so she provided, and she's Jewish herself, and Rachel Slade is also Jewish. They provided this window that I don't know much about. And so I thought it was fascinating for me as a non-Jew to read this piece.
You know, it's also important. I forgot. She also mentions Roy Cohn, as she calls him, Trump's old mentor. We all know Cohn. She says Cohn had been Joe McCarthy's right hand in the Red Scare witch hunt of the 50s, the lawyer who helped send Julius and Ethel Rosenberg to the electric chair, a gay Jew who sold out Jews and homosexuals without a second thought. It's a really thoughtful piece, and I love that you print. I mean, I love when there's controversy.
Have you told
like
Shirley about your bar mitzvah class, Jim?
What about it? That I was number one?
What is I didn't know if you Shirley knew that about Jim. Our listeners do.
I'll
They've
send
heard
you the
it
photograph
many times. Number one in his bar mitzvah class.
Oh, really?
Yes,
wow.
His mother was very
where
proud.
Was your, where was your bar excited. Mitzvah? Where was your bar mitzvah?
In Philadelphia.
I know, but where was it? A hotel? Was it?
Well, the bar mitzvah itself was at the synagogue, Beth Zion, and then we had a little party afterwards at a.
I've only been to one bar mitzvah.
You should have been at mine. it was unbelievable.
Great times.
It's like a wedding.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I had a great time.
I've had a blast at a million of them.
I'm still counting the cash, let me tell you. All it's huge. Shirley, good to see you. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Shirley Young is a Boston Globe interim. She is the Boston Globe's interim editorial page editor and a WGBH contributor and a great business columnist when she's writing the business column. Coming up, a new initiative focuses on getting gang members off the corner and into the classroom. We'll talk to the folks behind College Bound Dorchester next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Gang. You know, one of the greatest failures of our education system is the school-to-prison pipeline, the trend where young people of color and lower-income students are disproportionately disciplined and funneled out of public schools and into the juvenile and criminal justice systems. Well, College Bound Dorchester is in the practice of reverse engineering this by creating a prison-to-school pipeline. They have a new initiative which focuses on getting gang members off the corner into the classroom. It's called Boston Uncornered. We're joined by Mark Culleton, the CEO of College Bound Dorchester. Good to meet you, Mark. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, guys.
Conan Harris, good to see you again, Senior Vice President of Policy and External Affairs of College Bound Dorchester. Conan, good to see you.
Great to see you as well, Jack.
Well, let's start with you, Mark. What's the to tell people what this program is about.
Yeah, so the basic insight is that gang-involved young people in our cities are the ones with the power and the potential to change the world. And if we engage with them and get close to them, love and support them, that they make different choices, and those choices reverberate throughout their families and their communities. And for far too long, we've been ignoring this population as a city and allowing our corners to be controlled by gangs and violence. And it's, we tell ourselves stories that they're bad people, but they're not. And if you get close to them, you find that they move from the corner to college, they graduate. And in that way, they really change the nature of communities that have been struggling with violence for years.
Conan, what is a negative core influencer? I'd never heard the term before.
So a core influencer is a young man that grew up in the neighborhood that's involved in gang behavior and is a key person within that neighborhood from a negative standpoint. And so because they have that influence, that when you connect with them, it has the potential to reverberate all throughout the neighborhood within their families because they are a main influencer in that neighborhood.
Even though they're an infinitesimally small percentage of the neighborhood in terms of numbers, their impact is huge. Yes.
Yeah, their impact is huge because the whole mindset is that if you connect with that person, you have the ability to change some of the dynamics within the neighborhood because they are the leader. When you deal with somebody who is a leader of a basketball team, you know, what happens is that the rest of the team follows, or that's what you hope. And same thing within our neighborhood street gangs, is that if you touch the leader of that that crew, what happens is that the rest of the neighborhood catches on and start to think about doing things in a more positive way.
Well, Conan, you have some experience with this yourself because you grew up, you were arrested, I think, the first time in seventh grade.
Yes.
You had a buddy that was killed when he was just 14 years old. Explain to people that a little bit more of that dynamic, because you do see the bad boys got the strut, they got the you know, there's a real appeal.
So first and foremost, the reason why it was such an appeal to be even involved with College Bound and do public safety out of the mayor's office, and this has been my life work, is because I am those young people. I grew up in the neighborhood where gangs was just beginning in Boston, and I was involved in a gang as a young man. And what we realized even back then is that if you penetrate the particular neighborhood and work with folks in a deliberate way, and really give them an opportunity to put the gun away and put something in place of it, that's when you start to open the door to real opportunity. And College Bound and Uncornered is a movement to help connect those resources to the right young people.
And Mark, my understanding is a couple of the kinds of resources are mentors. You could describe who they are, and money, which is a pretty critical piece of this. Fill in both those blanks, if you would.
Right. So getting close to and supporting core influencers is challenging work, but the model is pretty simple. One, you hire and support and train formerly gang-involved individuals from particular crews who serve as mentors, guides, uncles, older brothers to active gang members. We call them college readiness advisors. The second thing that we believe in the power of high expectations, and so we are the only gang intervention program in the country that has college as a baseline expectation. And you see our college matriculation rate is 70%, and nationally college gang-involved youth matriculate at less than 1%. So those high expectations change behavior. And then finally, we believe you have to give young people the opportunity to focus on education. And so we're not afraid to pay our young people, to give them stipends, to allow them to make that journey from the corner to college.
What's that, $400 a week or something like that?
$400 a week, that's correct.
Why did you, was that a defensive statement by you when you said, Mark, we're not afraid to? What I read into that was, do you take heat for that? I mean,
yeah, you can imagine. Yeah, well, what makes you think that?
So explain what the criticism is and then respond to the criticism.
So many people say, why are you paying gang members? Like, what about the good kids? And the kids that don't get involved, why aren't you paying them? And what we're saying is that this population that, as you point out, is so small, it's 3,800 individuals in Boston. It's about 1% of the population, that if you engage them effectively, it helps the good kids. It helps everybody in the community. But these young men and women need an opportunity to make different choices, that they are stuck in a lifestyle where they need to be part of a way to make money, to support their family or whatever. And $400 is a small amount compared to what we currently pay for an active gang member's cost the Commonwealth $100,000 per year in adjudication and incarceration. And so it's less than we're currently paying for these young people, and it allows them to make fundamentally different choices and become college graduates that then uplifts those streets and those corners.
Well, Conan, I do know that some kids that aren't gang members, they are making money and supporting the family. So is the idea, if you get the $400 a week, that you can support the family in a different way? Or is this to use toward college? Or is this to use to rent your apartment? Or what's it for?
This is for living, right? I think that a lot of times you have young people involved in neighborhoods that are selling drugs, that are in a lifestyle of negativity because they're trying to provide for their family or provide for themselves. And this gives them a way to not have to worry, to focus on their education, not have to worry about getting a job as well, not worrying about having to hustle and do something else after you go to school, but really saying, we're going to pay you to focus on your education. And the whole Uncornered movement is about later on, once you get your degree, you're uncornered from your station, your situation, and your placement in life. And now you get the opportunity to go out and get your own career and do what you need to be doing
but
for your life.
But, you know, kind of when I hear you say that, I mean, that appeals to me. But let's go back to younger Conan Harris.
Yes.
If this same deal had been offered to you or to your friends, I mean, would you have said yes? Or would you say, wait a second, I'm the coolest guy in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
I'm the toughest guy in the neighborhood. And now they want me to be uncool, doing school and doing all these touchy-feely, kind of working with a mentor.
Mm-hmm.
I'm happy where I am, even if intellectually it's an interesting offer. You know,
don't Don't get it mixed up. I think that immediately when you hear the pitch, you're always going to be skeptical. We was raised to be skeptical of systems and situations. But one of the major things that College Bound has is their CRAs. Their CRAs are from the neighborhood. So
College
it isn't Jim
Readiness Advisors.
College
Thank
Readiness Advisors.
Much.
It isn't Jim Browdy telling us. It's the guy that grew up with us around the corner, who's an older guy that we used to look up to, who knows my uncle, my brother, my cousin. And so because of that, there's a trust that already exists that will allow us to be put in a situation to help us overall.
You know, for people who are skeptical about that, and I'm sounding skeptical, in my younger life, I was a city councilor for a brief period. You may know some city councilors, you guys. I don't know. But in any case, I went to a program when I was a city councilor I did not want to go to, but I felt I had to because I was afraid it was going to cost me votes. It was called the STARS program, and it was about teen dating violence. And I frankly was not that interested, and I thought it was going to be another BS kind of session. And the people leading the session, not unlike College Readiness Advisors, these mentors, were kids who had perpetrated dating violence against other kids. So the kids sitting in the audience were so transformed by the, as opposed, as you say, me or Marjorie or some, I mean, it really does when it's somebody who's lived the experience is a whole different thing.
We hear this all the time, Jim and Manji. Representation matters, right? And so when you see somebody who grew up in that neighborhood moving in a different direction, service in the neighborhood in a positive way, somebody we used to look up to in a negative light, now we look up to in a positive light, and they're coming to us with a pathway to get out of their circumstances, that is all the convincing. That's part of the convincing that is needed. Now, don't get me wrong. Immediately, everybody's skeptical because nobody believes in systems. We're living a certain way for a reason, and we stay away from all those pro-social things on purpose. But once you start to get involved with College Bound and the Uncornered movement, then you start to have a belief system that we're there for you, that there's support there. And so you have those College Readiness Advisors, but overall the program wraps around you.
We're talking to Conan Harris and Mark Culleton from College Bound Dorchester. Mark, how do you then pay for college?
Well, the truth is that most of these young people come from such poverty that the college is paid for, and it's really those other expenses that this $400 goes to pay. I would just add something about the payment too, is many of the programs go to these young people and say, join this and do the right thing just because. And by giving money and by saying we're investing in you too, It's not, we understand, the mentor understands the challenges associated with that. And then we're saying, we're in this with you. We're raising private dollars to allow you to make this choice. And there may be a voice inside the young person that wants to be cool or whatever, but there's also a voice that wants to get out of this, that wants to make the right choices, that wants to do something different for their kids or for their mother. And so we did a lot of data analysis and spent a lot of years to understand how much is enough to allow the young person to listen to that voice and make good choices.
Is there any government money involved in this, or is it all private sector?
So about 20% of our dollars are through public funds. Primarily, it's privately raised.
So we talked a minute ago, we were talking to Conan, how do you convince a gang member that this works for them, or could work for them? Let's go one step up or one step over on the scale. How do you convince the school to take a chance on a kid who's got a pretty scary background?
Well, so you have to spend a lot of time. The reason why we love the term uncornered is because it's about uncornering our neighborhoods, but also about uncornering minds. So you have to have relationships with the presidents, with the guidance counselors, with everybody within those institutions. Thankfully, we started Uncornered in Boston, where we have Roxbury Community College, Bunker Hill, Benjamin Franklin, where we have those types of relationships, and they want to see redemption and opportunity. And our young people are matriculating, graduating, staying in school better than anybody else because they have the supports and because they can focus. And so that success breeds additional confidence in these young people.
Mm-hmm. You know, we're talking with Mark Carlton and Conan Harris about College Bound Dorchester. You know, one of the saddest stories I've read in a long time was a story the Globe did in the magazine about the valedictorians out of the high schools in Boston, where these kids who had stayed out of trouble, got to be 17, 18, valedictorians of their class, a lot of them from poverty, a lot of them from other countries. And then they went to Boston College or they went to Northeastern. They couldn't get through. And the mentorship that you guys are talking about,
it was key.
Talk a little bit about that situation where you get to BC and you're like, you may as well be on Mars.
Well, the whole thing, I think that when folks graduate from high school, everybody thinks, oh, they've made it. They arrived. The whole key is around wraparound and supporting them throughout the process. You can't get them to college and all of a sudden think that they arrive. You got to make sure that they have the support systems around them so they can successfully transition in college and then successfully graduate. You have to keep a hand on them. What we saw with the valedictorians is that they was going through college and high school and did a great job and then got to college and everybody thought they would arise and stepped away. You got to stay hand in hand with young people to make sure that they have the support services needed. I look at myself, I went to college later on in life and as an adult, and I did really well, but I was pulling my hair out all the classes. You know, you go through different stress levels, you go through those levels of insecurity, and if you don't have people to talk to or people to engage with when you're starting to have those feelings, those second thoughts, then you will fall out and fail. So it is so crucial and so important to make sure that our young people have our CRAs and that are supporting them all the way through.
Is anybody else doing this anywhere?
So we've learned a ton from really great programs around the country about great street outreach, great sort of college access and opportunity programs. But we are the only program in America, and so I say in the world, that focuses on gang-involved individuals and gets them into and through college. And really, we just provide them the support. It's this idea of shifting the mindset to core influencers want to do this and are powerful change agents in a way that we've never done in this country. We've never really addressed generational urban poverty. And we feel like these young people, we just support them. They can actually do it. They can change the nature of Mattapan, Dorchester, Roxbury. We just have to give them the opportunity.
Can you? You've said it twice, Mark, but I think it bears repeating a third time because we're all skeptics about anything, particularly when it comes. Well, whatever. Talk about the success rate. I mean, demonstrate to people that this works rather than that it's a noble experiment that you and Conan and some others believe in. Give us the data.
Right. So 70% matriculation rate, 69% retention rate. These are all numbers that are double or triple national for average students in college. 68% drop in recidivism, meaning when young people come to us, they don't commit crimes again. And most importantly, our young people are then recruiting their crews, and we have two, maybe even now three streets that were areas of violence where we got to four or five members of that crew, and we just got close to them and gave them the supports. And those streets have now gone from places of violence to places of opportunity right in Dorchester and Roxbury. And that type of impact on the community is really what this is about. And those core influencers, the students that we love, are agents of change.
You mentioned, Conan, a minute ago, you worked until recently for Marty Walsh. Is Walsh on board here?
Yeah, the mayor's been on board since the beginning. When I worked for the mayor's Office of Public Safety, that's how I transitioned over to College Bound, because our job in the public safety office was to work with many different organizations that was doing violence intervention and prevention work. College Bound was right there dealing with public safety and making sure that they're supporting this particular population. And it was a mandate on the mayor to make sure that we all follow suit.
You know, when I hear you talk about the stipend, Marjorie and I talked about it a lot this morning before you guys came in. I mean, obviously, it can, not only can you afford the incidentals in college, but you can live better. And living conditions are a huge thing. And Conan, for you in particular, I want you to listen to this woman we had on the show recently who's had some issues around living conditions. Maybe you could make a recommendation for her. We asked her about her living conditions. Here's what she had to say.
So I'm very fortunate. A member of the Oregon delegation, Suzanne Bonamici, who's in her fifth term, allowed me to sort of crash on her couch for the last month or so.
So it's a really sad story. I can't remember who it was. It was somebody who was on the show, and she moved to Washington part-time, and she's sleeping on a couch. Do you have any advice? I mean, because I know you deal with situations like this.
Oh, man.
Do you have any advice for her?
My advice for that brilliant woman is I'm so grateful that we got tapped into great resources, and now she's no longer on a couch. And she's in a bed now, in her own bed and in her own place. But we're grateful to our beautiful our congresswoman colleague that supported us, what allowed us to sleep on the couch.
By the way, everybody knows that was the voice of Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, who just happens to be the spouse of Conan Harris. You know, Conan, Marjorie asked this question of the congresswoman the other day. There's a story in the paper. You left City Hall. You started a consulting business. People have raised issues about ethical concerns and those. How are you and your wife dealing with this so that people feel there aren't conflicts of interest, there are not problems?
So one of the major things is so important is that, one, I don't even have time because my major focus has been on College Bound Dorchester and making sure we're doing everything here to make sure that people are partners in what we're doing in Uncornered Movement. But secondly, before we even make any movements, I went through the orientations of ethics, and our federal ethics department is partners with every congressperson and their spouse. And we have our state ethics here that has been very supportive. So anything that
And you've consulted with all those places.
Yes, I consult with all of them to make sure that anything that I'm doing is right up to par and would never put my wife or our family in jeopardy of any kind.
You know, Mark, before you guys go, we're going to give the web address in a couple of seconds. Are there other opportunities for people? I mean, obviously, if people want to give money, that's fabulous. Are there volunteer opportunities? What can an average person listening who believes in this, I love the term uncornered movement. I just love that.
Yeah.
Who want to participate in that? Are there ways in?
Yeah, so there are volunteer opportunities both in our locations in Dorchester and Roxbury, on college campuses, opportunities to tutor. And I would just say, a huge part of this movement is about getting close to each other. It's about the power of proximity. And so we love when anybody, with or without money, skeptics or champions, to come and visit and spend some time with our CRAs and our students, and you'll see the brilliance and possibility of these young people that are right here in our city. And so that, more than anything, I would ask people to come and see and talk to people, and you too will become uncornered and be part of the movement.
Great. It's great to see you both.
Okay, along those lines, if anybody wants to learn more about College Bound Dorchester, what you do is you go to collegebounddorchester.org. Mark Culleton is the CEO of College Bound Dorchester. Conan Harris is the Senior Vice President of Policy and External Affairs. Thank you both very much.
Exciting. Good luck
for coming in. Great. Congratulations on what sounds like a great program.
Thank you guys so much for the opportunity.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, a new Frontline documentary looks at what happened when New York decided it was okay for people with severe mental illness to live on their own. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is 89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1, Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She's Marjorie Egan. So what happens when people with serious mental illness slip through the cracks? That's what a new Frontline and ProPublica documentary looks into. It's called Right to Fail, and it investigates a court-ordered effort in New York City to move thousands of mentally disabled people from adult homes into independent apartments. But for many of them, independence means extreme isolation. As Abraham Clemente, one of the supposed beneficiaries of this ruling, put it, quote, "I just want to live like a human being."
Instead, this investigation found him living in subhuman conditions. You can watch Right to Fail online at pbs.org/WGBH/frontline. We're joined by Frontline producer and director Tom Jennings. Tom collaborated with ProPublica's Joaquin Sapien on Right to Fail. Tom, thanks so much and congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for joining us, Tom. So, tell us what the thesis is, what the point was here. Mine was that this experiment didn't seem to work, but I'm not the filmmaker or the producer. What were you trying to say here?
Well, it was a look at the kind of the iterative process that we're going through as a country, not just New York, with regard to the process of deinstitutionalization, which is a fairly unique American phenomenon, going from giant state hospitals where hundreds of thousands of people have been housed for decades to, in the 1950s and 60s, closing them down, beginning that process. It's decades old now. And finding a solution, which has been to push and bring people into the community. And deinstitutionalization is not just about getting rid of buildings. It's about bringing people out of an institutionalized setting that institutionalizes their thinking. So deinstitutionalization is the process of giving people complete independence. And, along the way, we've seen the various iterations of that in every state, including Massachusetts. There's been a kind of a phased process of pulling people into the community, usually with the interim process or the interim structure of what we call adult homes in New York, but every state has its own version. These are usually for-profit run businesses that house people without the benefit of a lot of psychiatric medical care on site. And now we're at the next phase, which is getting people out of those situations, which are oftentimes not good, and into their own apartments and living independently. So what we wanted to do was, at first, really, was test all of that, see what was happening. And we thought, well, this we'll do another thing on adult homes, which Cliff Levy of the New York Times had done in 2002, won a Pulitzer for, and found terrible despair and conditions. And we thought, well, what's going on now? What we found was that after that investigation, a federal court's order was issued, an 11-year process, that resulted in 4,000 people being given the choice to live independently if they wanted to. And so we decided to look and see how that was going.
You know, when you say independent, for those who haven't seen this yet, Tom, for haven't seen Right to Fail, independent means independent. I mean, when Marjorie and I were talking before you came on, in Massachusetts, our understanding of, quote, independence is usually a group home kind of setting with common space. You have your own room, so there is some level of independence. But the people, Clemente and Bunch and Walker, we'll talk about some of them in a couple of minutes, men you followed, literally had their own apartments like probably most people listening had, theoretically, and that's the critical word, I think, with a support structure in place that would make that a success. That's an accurate characterization, correct?
Yeah, no, you nailed it. It's exactly that. The idea of this federal court settlement, was a civil rights issue, really. People were being segregated into this tier of group homes, these big group homes. And usually they're in places far outside of the center of town, in the perimeter of the city, the outskirts. And they're, quite literally segregated from the community. And the federal court decision was saying, you can't do that. That's not constitutional. You're invading people's rights. And so the decision was to use a program that's been in existence since the early 1990s across the country called supported housing. And it's been used in a variety of contexts for a variety of populations. It hasn't been used so much for people with serious mental disabilities like the people that we're talking mm-hmm. about. But that's what was fairly unique in 2014 when this started to really be put into process, this settlement. Was that it was a very, it was giving people with the most serious mental disabilities the right to choose to live alone with the presumption that the system would bring the services of care and support to them, to their apartment where they were living independently, completely independently. You're right.
So I mentioned Abraham Clemente in the open here. And by the way, I practically cried when he said those words. I felt like a human being for the first time. But can you trace for us fairly briefly, Tom, the ups and downs of the independent, and I use that term in quotes, life of Mr. Clemente?
Abraham Clemente is a 69-year-old man who has who's first diagnosed with schizophrenia at age 17. And his life has been, you know, kind of a reflection of the deinstitutionalization process. He's spent time in hospitals and psychiatric hospitals. He's spent time homeless. He spent time in jails where he was, you know, he found himself after, you know, several incidents that were very clearly the result of his diagnosis. And he ended up in the adult homes, too. And at this point in his life, he's a person who has a lot of difficulties living alone. And what's so interesting about his story is that we found him last summer in July. It was a very hot summer, and we kept on visiting him. And the state of disrepair, for people who haven't seen the film, is something to behold. Oh. And I don't even think I did it justice in the film, to be honest.
It was awful. We could see how awful it was. And you can tell us about his finger in a second.
Well, he was living... He had, by the time that we connected with him, he had been refusing care for months, and he had been off of his medications. He was cycling out of control. He was in a full flight of what we call decompensation. When somebody with serious mental illness, their symptoms are, you know, fully fledged. They're coming out and really making it difficult. And he was endangering himself, and I think other people, his neighbors in this apartment building where he lived, felt the same thing. We talked to a lot of his neighbors. And prior, what was interesting about his story that we couldn't really quite get into the film was that there was in the records that we found, that was the support system. That was the basis of our reporting for all of these cases. Showed that a lot of people were saying before he was given his apartment that he probably shouldn't be given his apartment. He's not a good choice. This is not a good idea necessarily in this case. And the system, by its own kind of weight and its own momentum, you know, disregarded all of that and allowed him to live independently. Because he said at that point, and he was healthy at the time, he said he wanted to. And so the system in New York allowed him to do that. And within 2 months of him getting his apartment, while those 2 months had been actually pretty good, he quickly, you know, declined. And he quickly started refusing services. And like I say, by the time we found him, he was fully into a decompensated state.
And tell us about his finger, which you showed, this enormously swollen finger.
Yeah.
What happened?
it's terribly sad. We were there. We visited him. And one of the first things that we saw was his middle left-hand finger was... you know, exaggeratedly swollen in a way that clearly indicated infection. What he had done, he had as part of his diagnosis, his schizophrenia, he's an avid collector, and he was building shelves out of things that he found on the street, and he'd gotten a hammer and some nails, and he'd put a nail through his middle finger.
Oh,
as God. He was building it. There's actually a hole in his finger that you can see today still that's right in the middle. But the finger was so swollen you couldn't even see the hole at the time. But he had to actually pull his finger off that nail, and then he didn't do anything about it, you know, and it festered and it became infected. And the caregiver agency that was overseeing him did not take him to the hospital. You know, it was one of these very simple things. They did eventually. By the time that we found it and found him, and we made it clear to them that he needed some care, they did. They took him in. But it was kind of a dangerous situation. I saw him 3 weeks ago and visited him. His finger's much better. There's still residue from it, but it's much better.
You know, to sort of sum up the several sides of this thing. It was a really good back and forth. It actually upset me, but it was a really good back and forth between a woman by the name of Antonia Lasicki, I hope I got it right, from the Association for Community, on the importance of giving people who are eligible for this kind of independent supportive housing the choice of where they want to live, followed by your colleague, Joaquin Sapien, questioning the morality of letting people with debilitating mental illness make these life-altering decisions. Here's her, then him.
In order for somebody to have agency, dignity, integrity, they have to be able to make a choice, even if those choices are bad choices.
It does seem like we're at a point now where we're letting people who hallucinate your voices, are very delusional, make their own decisions on where they should live.
We are doing that. Absolutely. I tend to take the position of more freedom is better than less freedom. But there are cases where you have to wonder, like, you know, what are we doing?
Exactly. And I have to say, watching this thing where she says in the abstract, and I only know this woman through you, is they have to be able to make bad choices, too. I tend to take the position more freedom is better than less. You know, it's easy for someone to say in an office. The takeaway for me is from this film is that a court made a decision. And the government said, with some exceptions, that good luck to you, and we'll see you when we can. But, you know, the fact that whatever is called the Office of Mental Health in New York was not even willing to grant a government entity, not willing to grant an on-screen interview to you and your colleague, to me says everything you need to know. They have independence, but government is not willing to give them the support that they clearly need to succeed.
And some of these were for-profits.
Oh, clearly. A lot of them are for-profit. Yeah. Is that an unfair characterization of what we learned from this, Tom?
I think that up until the for-profit, the adult home industry is a for-profit. That's where they're coming from. Those tend to be the places that have, you know, been quite investigated and proven to be very, they have a very poor reputation for care. What's interesting is that this federal court mandated system of care that New York undertook was managed by the same governmental entity that was sued by the federal government.
That's great.
For contracting with adult homes for all these years. And so there's, I think, you know, it's hard to characterize the Office of Mental Health and the Department of Health in New York, but they are kind of creatures of a certain status quo, let's say. And for years and years, you know, since the 1970s, they were working with the adult homes, and it fell into such disrepair that they got sued by the federal government. So they kind of came into this new system of independent living dragging their feet. And that's my characterization, but I think, you know, a lot of people would agree with me. And they did not really put, until fairly recently, a lot into this cumbersome, complex bureaucratic process that they, you know, they created the architecture for. They made a very complex, burdensome process that, at the end of the day, doesn't necessarily serve people who are some of the most vulnerable that we have in our society and need the most support that we possibly can give. And it's a difficult system to navigate for anybody, but especially if you have these kinds of disabilities.
We're talking to Frontline producer and director, Tom Jennings, and the new Frontline production is Right to Fail. You know, one of the things I was wondering about, Tom, is, you know, the gentleman we just talked about with the swollen finger, he seemed to have no family around him. Nestor lost his mother, who was a great advocate for mental health. In fact, you guys show a picture of her shaking the hand of Bill Clinton. For activism for mental health. But there was the other gentleman, Bernard, the man who was clearly in very bad shape mentally, running around without his clothes on, very cold weather, actually died at the bottom of the stairs. He had a brother who was a retired police officer. And, you know, just from the little bit I know about mental health and child welfare in Massachusetts, you really have to have a family member, you know, kind of on the back of the bureaucracy. And I wondered what the cop, was he involved with his brother Bernard? It seemed like he was not.
You know, he wasn't at the time that Bernard was living in the adult home. He wasn't in a substantive way. He certainly was in a brotherly way. You know, personally, I had a brother who had severe bipolar, and it was a challenge for the family forever until he died, and it's the hardest for anybody. And there's so many people who tell this kind of story that I'm talking about now. It's a hard thing for family. It's a very difficult thing. And so, what do? We hope at that point in time when something like this does happen, that there is an apparatus that's around to help us. And that's what the Walker family was doing. It wasn't just Michael. It was his whole family, his mother, his wonderful, beautiful mother, Rosetta, who was deeply, deeply concerned and caring for Michael. And then a support system of sisters and siblings and extended family. They all embraced and had a very strong community. He was loved. He was a very loved and cared for person. Yet at the same time, he was an adult, and he wanted his independence.
Right.
He wanted to try living alone. And so what are you going to do? You want to support him in any way you possibly can. That's what they were doing. And he, you know, lived for, you know, 2 months in independent housing in a supported care apartment until things went bad.
So I hate this expression, but I'm going to use it anyway. What's the takeaway here? That nonprofits are a disaster. We should go back to, that for-profits are a disaster. We should have the government overseeing everything. Obviously, the bureaucracy is
well. The
all...
government, by the way, theoretically does oversee it, even though they are for-profits.
Well, and you
they
guys
just
made,
took a walk.
Well, you guys made the point, that, which is very common, that one agency doesn't talk to the other agency and it's very disorganized and uncoordinated, or that the idea of allowing people with severe mental illness to live alone when they are, as you point out in your story, actively hallucinating in some cases and not taking their medication is just a disaster. And the court made a mistake in even ruling this way.
Well, look, I think that the takeaway is – that's a different show, isn't it? I think that the takeaway is that is that we're at the end point. I got into this project because I am ceaselessly amazed at what we've done with people in our society who live with severe, serious mental illness. I have that personal connection, but it's also something that I think we all feel and don't really quite know what to do. And I'm also fascinated with this history of deinstitutionalization. So here we are at the end point of deinstitutionalization. That's where we are. And the whole point of that was to get people into the community. That's the process that we decided was best. And so we're doing that now. And when Tony Lisicki says we are doing that, we're giving people the right to choose to do that who are actively hallucinating, it sounds pretty horrifying. But, you know, if you step back and you think about it, you know, somebody, this is what was told to me at one point. Somebody who was regulating this said, look, they're going to hallucinate in the adult home or they're going to hallucinate in their apartment. Why not let them hallucinate in their apartment? It sounds cold and harsh, but that's the reality of these kinds of illnesses. So for me, the takeaway is this, is that you want to support this idea of supported housing. I think it's a good idea. I think supported care apartments are actually a great thing, but they're not a great thing if we don't give the actual support in supported care. It's not there. It's not a good idea if the coordination of care is a mess. It's not a good idea if there is this huge layer upon layer of bureaucracy that's on top of it that doesn't let, you know, good-hearted providers give the care that they need and want to give. And that's the problem at the end of the day. Is that we need to do a system. We need to have a system of care for people and give them their rights. It's a civil rights issue. Give them their independence, but give them all the support they need. Now, what's the problem? Funding, bureaucracy, intransigence, you know, inertia. It's all the things that we all know about. And I know, you know, in Massachusetts, it's been a problem. And, you know, Spotlight has done amazing work in this realm too. And I think that It's a societal commitment issue. Like, what are we deciding? What can we do? What are we willing to do as a society to support these people? And I feel it's a commitment. You know, you got to say, give them independence. It works. Supported housing actually does work. as we show at the end of the film.
Yep.
But it's only when you give them folks a lot of resources and do it the right way.
Tom, thanks for your work and thanks for your time.
Congratulations.
We really
appreciate it. It's very eye-opening and very upsetting, and a great piece of journalism. Tom, thank you.
Thanks very much. I'm really thrilled to be with you.
Thank you. That was Frontline producer and director Tom Jennings, along with ProPublica's Joaquin Sapien. He made the documentary Right to Fail. You can watch it online at pbs.org/WGBH/frontline. As I said, it's a real eye-opening piece of journalism. Thanks again, Tom. Up next, we're opening the lines and asking you, what is your literal downfall? Do you pass out at the sight of blood like Jim? At the sight of a nurse aiming the needle
like
right
Jim.
At your arm like Jim? Or how about a crowded subway car? Not like Jim. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Brody. She's Marjorie Egan. If you're just tuning in, earlier in the show, we were talking to Art Kaplan, our medical ethicist, about vasovagal. I hope I got it right. Vasovagal syndrome. It's what happens when unpleasant situations make you pass out. For me, it's a phlebotomist. I've never actually passed out, but I've come close. When I see that, what was funny about that? Why do you find that funny?
I could just envision you getting your blood drawn.
Well, I'm a little squeamish. When I see that
sweat dripping down your forehead.
When I see that vial filling up with my blood, that's it. For others, it's getting vaccinated or even being in a cramped subway car. So what is it for you? 877-301-8970. And by the way, if you're a phlebotomist or a nurse, we'd love to hear from you. Or if you have nerves of steel, which you sort of do, Marjorie, what can you tolerate that the rest of us can't? I said this
I don't have nerves of steel, except compared to you.
Well, maybe.
But you weren't passing out in a crowded subway car, because we know what you used to do in those crowded subway cars.
Please, no, that's I lived in New York.
Back
that's
in the day.
That's all rumor.
Girls in their summer dresses.
No, that's in all seriousness, that's not funny.
Okay.
Okay,
all
so
right.
Getting back to the, as I said earlier in the show, whenever I have my blood taken.
It's a long record.
Whenever I have my blood taken, literally, you know how pathetic you are. When a phlebotomist who's half your age says at the end, oh, you're such a good patient, Mr. Browdy, or Mr. Brody, or whatever they say.
Where's
you're
little
such
Jimmy?
A good patient. Oh, I've never fainted, but I get really, I get it, there's like a feeling through your whole, or when people, people who are medical professionals talk about things they do that involve blood and things like that, it gets me. Is there nothing that gets you on that sort of lightheaded, other than drinking, that lightheaded kind of thing where you feel you could go down for the count?
Well,
no?
not these things.
Well,
not,
what are
not
those? Is there anything?
I don't know. I'm thinking. I hadn't thought about it. I was just thinking we were talking about getting vaccinated or getting blood.
Well,
drawn.
Needles, as Art Kaplan
needles.
Says, for a lot of people, just the sight of the needle. It's not even the pain of the needle injecting.
Well, I think
in
lots of people turn away. I don't like to see the needle going into my skin. I just assume turn away. But I find it actually once the needle's in there,
love that.
And they get the little tube.
Ooh.
It's kind of fun to watch the blood come out and go down the little tube and go into those vials. You always do wonder why they need 14 different vials of blood. It always seems a little
You know why?
There.
I know why.
Why?
They're sadists. That's why. So
but the color of your blood is kind of interesting.
That to me is it's rich. You mean it's like no, it's rich and dark.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's
very
amazing.
Nice. Make a good lipstick.
Okay,
shade.
That has nothing to do with what we're talking about. We're talking about vasovagal syndrome, which you encounter an unpleasant situation. Maybe it's a claustrophobia of a cramped subway car. Maybe it's the sight of blood, and you either pass out or about to. And I want to know if I'm aberrational. Again, I've never. Fully passed out.
You know what the big one is?
My blood's being drawn, but I do get really uncomfortable and I have a physical feeling that is really unpleasant. What's a big one?
The big one is childbirth. You hear about all sorts of men who are in there for the birth
of their child
and their wife is having a difficult time and the husband passes out at the bottom of the table. You hear that a lot where men can't quite deal with that. Paul says he passes out whenever he sees Donald Trump in front of a microphone.
I don't know if that's a vasovagal kind of thing. 877-301-8970. So are there examples in your life where you – and also it would be great because I would – every time I do this, I say to myself, next time I'm going to be more grown up. And Art said you can outgrow – didn't Art say this too? I think I asked him.
Yes, you can
train
yourself.
You can outgrow it if you train – oh, he said like fear of flying. You can train yourself. I would like to not be as childish in my response to seeing blood, particularly mine, but I think anybody's.
But I can't break out.
But there's
out
an
of
explanation,
it.
They say, because your blood pressure goes down. There's a triggering event like the blood or getting overheated or standing for a long time or feeling you're going to get hurt. And the body responds by slowing down. The heart rate and blood pressure both drop. And then when they lower too much, then, of course, that's when the person passes out.
Yeah. What I've done, by the way, I was saying I was trying to come up with, you know, how to deal with it. The way I often deal with it, I make sure that when I'm having my blood taken, I prop myself up in the chair at an angle so that even – I'm serious. Even if I did pass out, I'd be, like, in a position where they wouldn't even know that I had departed
temporarily. Well, that's one of the bits of advice. You either get in an angle or you actually lie all the way down.
I didn't know that. Is that
true? Yeah, because if you faint and you're already lying on the stretcher or the bed or whatever it is, it's not as big of a deal as if you fall – you know, redwood tree-like, as some of the people might, that could be a little
whereas
bit more
of our emailers at our old station said, Anchorman down. That was the day when I fell on the ice about 10 years ago. And for some reason, Marjorie and the listeners thought it was a riot. So all I did was hit the back of my head. So it wasn't that big a deal, really.
No, I'm very concerned about your health, Jim. Yeah, you know that. Julia from Arlington.
Hi, Julia.
Hi, Julia. Hello. How are you today?
Great.
Fine, thanks.
So I have exactly the condition you guys are talking about, but it's not at all related to needles or blood. I'm fine with all of that.
What is it?
But I don't know exactly what it is, but I've passed out 20 to 30 times, and my doctor says it's a vasovagal thing. My blood pressure is typically very low, so that's part of it. But the only answer is to eat a lot more salt. And that seems to actually help a lot.
But didn't we read yesterday that we really have to limit salt? I mean, it's helping with your vasovagal.
Well, again, I don't have any of the indicators of, you know, I don't have any heart conditions
or high
blood pressure that you'd have to watch out for salt. But I'm supposed to try to eat 5 grams of salt a day, which if you know how much that is, that's a lot.
So do you do it?
No.
Oh, oh, well, okay.
But I do other stuff.
Like what?
Okay, so first what I really want to say, I haven't figured this out for myself, but there is this thing called Z-Health, which you can read about, and there are practitioners around the Boston area.
And what is it?
Contact. And they basically give you little exercises to do to recalibrate your system.
Oh.
And I've only received so far one exercise, and
what
it's
it?
Really just breathing deeply the right way. So it turns out I was only breathing with the left side of my body and not the right. And
was that
so
what
my exercise is to breathe evenly.
Was Hillary Clinton talking about that on the campaign trail, that she was breathing only? Didn't she?
Well, she had that collapse that we also had a picture
of her. It was something independent. Julia, thanks for your call, by the way, and thanks for the breathing recommendation. There was something that she said she was not physiologically doing properly, or I don't know what it was.
Paul sent his copy of a medical journal, which talks about this
what?
Being a treatable problem. You need to learn how to raise your blood pressure, which has something to do with tensing and squeezing your large muscle groups.
If I had a large muscle group, I'd be squeezing it. Pauline, you're in Shrewsbury. You're next on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about vasovagal. I never even heard of the term. Vasovagal syndrome or whatever it's called. Hi, Pauline.
Hi. Hi, Tim and Mike. Love your show. Listen as often as I can. And
thank you.
I totally have this syndrome, but I started to listen to you, Jim, but I heard you say you never went down. I go down, I go out, I'm gone all the time. It is, but mine is definitely fear of needles, fear of blood, fear of going to the doctor, I just don't do any of that well. I've been in some situations where I've said, I have a child now, I can beat this, and I'm passed out on the floor in my pediatrician's office with my child getting the shot.
I shouldn't laugh. You know, Pauline, we got to let you go. It has nothing to do with the content. The connection is horrible. I'm sorry. Thank you for sharing your story. So apparently I'm not that aberrational. I don't actually pass out. I just come close, I guess.
Edward said he passed out when he went with his father to a dialysis appointment. The doctor was explaining what dialysis entailed, and that was it for Edward. Not even
really?
He wasn't even the patient.
Well, I have to say, for me, the description of unpleasant medical things has a similar effect on me.
Stephen says he passes out when he learns something totally shocking. For example, he said, I fainted dead away when I found out that a massage parlor staffed by young Asian women in a strip
mall
actually involved in prostitution.
By the way, how do you pronounce, is it syncope? Is that how you say that word?
Syncope, thank you. Vasovagal syncope, thank you, Tori. Affects Robert. A lot. This is what Tori does. Vasovagal syncope affects a lot of women, so naturally there isn't much research.
Of course.
You know, which I think most people will understand out there. Yeah.
Robert says he saw you pass out, Jim, at Whole Foods after they broke down the hot food bar for the day.
By the way, one of the most depressing things, this is nothing to do with vasovagal.
Uh-huh. Yep.
When you're ready to go to Whole Foods for the hot bar, and you know it's on the border if it closes at 10 o'clock, and you're getting there at 8:45, and you're not sure if they've broken it down or not, isn't that like one of the worst feelings? You don't know you're approaching the hot bar.
Really...
You don't know until you turn the corner whether it's broken down. It's just horrible.
Oh, God, I wouldn't know. But the suspense, I suppose, Jim, might kill you in a very desperate situation.
By the way, you know what's interesting about this? Almost every caller is a woman. In fact, every caller is a woman.
Okay. Greta is a woman, we presume. Hi, Greta.
Hello, Greta. Welcome.
Hi, Jim and Marjorie.
Hi.
I'm calling. I've never heard that term, vasovagal, but I can relate to the symptoms.
Yeah.
First time was passing out at a doctor's office just with the doctor asking me if I had any questions, and it was a normal exam, like nothing was wrong. And then recently, I was 9 months pregnant and cut my finger just cleaning a knife in the sink and passed out. Luckily, my husband is right there to catch me. But it's been, it's crazy. I just had my daughter a couple weeks ago via planned C-section, and I had so much anxiety going into it. I definitely thought I was going to keep you awake for the surgery, and I just was freaking out thinking about, passing out during it or not, remembering my daughter and stuff. But luckily,
how is everybody?
Breathing and
how is everybody?
Everyone's good. Yeah.
Oh, great! Congratulations.
Yeah, good. Thank you. But yeah, it was. I definitely identify with crazy amounts of anxiety with any kind of doctor situation or hospital.
Greta, don't go away yet. So the first situation, I can't believe I shouldn't laugh, and I'm so I apologize. He asked you questions, and you passed out.
Oh, yeah. No, it was literally, I had my usual annual exam with my doctor, and everything was done, and I was sitting on the table, and she said, "Do you have any questions?" And I just said, "I don't feel well," and then the next thing I remember, I woke up, and she was handing me a glass of water. And
nothing horrible was going on. There was no question about anything?
No, nothing.
It's unbelievable.
No, it's a mental thing, like kind of, you mentioned there, one of the callers, it's just my brain. I don't think there's anything wrong with my body, but, my brain just shuts down.
Greta, congratulations on the kid, and thanks for the call. Did you know this was as widespread as it appears to be?
I didn't. I thought it was. I didn't at all. But lots of people are.
What are they saying? Blood is a big part of this, right?
Well, this is a needle one. Women that have had amniocentesis, where they have that big, huge needle.
Sure.
Jeffrey said, I was never affected, but when my wife was about to have that amniocentesis, he knew what was going to happen. But as the doctor approached my wife's abdomen with that rather massive needle, next thing he knows, he wakes up on a stretcher.
So here's an email from Martin. I ran a blood drive at Tufts, and the floor was littered with football players hitting the deck. Small guys and girls encountered no problem. Martin emails, it was always the big guys fainting.
Well, maybe there's something to that. You're a big guy.
Maybe
it has to do with distance from the floor.
I'm actually a little less embarrassed by my reaction to the phlebotomist in light of what everybody else has been describing here. So where do you want to go? You pick.
Let's go to Cheryl in Norwell. Hi, Cheryl.
Cheryl.
Oh, hi. How are you?
We're good. Thank you.
Long-time listener. Love you guys.
Thanks.
I'm so excited you're talking about this. It's making me laugh to hear the stories because I've been this has happened to me since I was a kid.
Wow.
And I went through all kinds of testing. They thought, I might have a seizure disorder because of very low blood pressure. So when it drops, when you pass out, it gets dangerously low, apparently. You kind of go into a seizure mode. So that was ruled out. Now my family just laughs at me. I've learned over the years the best thing you can do is to get down. It's the fall that will hurt you. So I don't get as embarrassed by it anymore, but I have grown out of it somewhat, learned to manage it. I think it's a combination of, a learned coping anxiety with the biology of the low blood pressure. But quick, funny story about the pregnancy, hearing all this.
Sure.
My first child, I was so terrified I was going to pass out. I didn't have time for the epidural, and the nurse maternity nurse at the time said to me, oh, don't worry. She said, this kind of pain won't let you pass out. And she was absolutely right. I was unfortunately awake through the whole thing. So my second child, I went in and I had time for the epidural. And I was too afraid the epidural was going to make me pass out. So I declined the epidural and went through naturally. So I endured both pains without passing out. But the littlest thing, like talking about blood or seeing blood or injuring myself, will set me down. So anyway.
Cheryl, great one. Thanks. That was a great story.
Yeah, those epidural needles are pretty big,
too. By the way, we should be, so we're not scaring people. I'm just reading from this piece at health.com. While the experience of vasovagal syncope is not pleasant, it's not a harbinger of a serious illness or condition. It's a totally benign syndrome. It's not associated with any other heart problems.
Right.
But as you and others are saying, preparing for the fall, when you're in a circumstance where you know it may happen,
well,
apparently
also,
it's the most important
they
thing.
Say that usually you do get some physical warning signs, like you feel lightheaded, or you get tunnel vision, you're slightly nauseous or sweaty or clammy, you just don't feel good. So the advice is, once you get those sensations, sit down or lie down right away.
Yeah, you know, when I get the sensation, when the phlebotomist says, "Mr. Brown, this is not going to hurt," as soon as I hear that,
but when they say, "This is only going to hurt a little," like at the dentist,
really,
it's like, ah!
No, it is. It's really, it's embarrassing. I'm less embarrassed actually because there's so many people who have a variation on that thing.
Kate's suspicious. She said her husband conveniently claims that he will faint and has to leave the room when anything involves, you know, any messy things with the children, like the diapers or the dog, anything that has to do with chucking up or anything. Conveniently, it's too upsetting for him, and of course, she has to do it. I'm with you, Kate. I'm suspicious.
So, what did we learn? Did we learn anything from this?
A lot of people are falling down and landing on stretchers.
Or fainting.
Yeah.
Well, that's it. We're out of time.
Yeah, that's it. Oh, we're out of time.
That's how it works. You have a segment, it ends, you go to the next segment. You know, that's pretty much how these radio shows work there.
Okay. Up next, we're going to talk.
Vasovagal syncope. You never heard. Did you ever hear the term
never
before?
Never heard the term.
Nor
never
did
heard
I.
The term. Although I fainted before.
But you said you didn't faint before.
I did. You know, it's like after a tough night. You know what I mean?
Excuse me? No, I don't know what you
lots
mean.
Lots of people can have that experience. Get a little dehydrated, you know.
Bet.
You're standing up and
okay,
all of a sudden.
Then.
Okay, up next, the world's Carolyn Beeler joins us from aboard the Nathaniel D. Palmer in Antarctica. That's a research vessel. And she's going to give us an update on her expedition. Carolyn Beeler, next, going where no other human beings have gone before, she and her crew. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Carolyn Beeler is the environment reporter for The World. She's now 5 weeks into her Antarctica expedition, living along scientists who are studying how quickly the Thwaites Glacier will melt and what it will mean for global sea levels and coastal cities. She joins us on the line yet again for an update. Carolyn, it's great to hear from you.
You too, yeah.
Wow, you sound like you're right next door there,
she
Carolyn.
Does. It's amazing,
it's
actually.
It's unbelievable. So we know you've been up there at Thwaites for a while, and you started doing all the science stuff. But before you get to the science stuff, you talked about how there were these huge winds and you had to move away. What was that about?
Oh, yeah. So the weather changes really fast down here. So once we did the first pass along the face of the glacier and mapped some of the sea floor there that had been uncharted previously, a pretty big storm system came up and we had winds gusting at something like 60 knots, I think. So they, you know, turned the ship a little bit away from the face of the glacier, I think both for safety reasons and because the one thing they can do in high winds is map different parts of the sea floor. So we had a gusty day or two and some really, really gloomy weather before coming back a little bit closer to the face of the ice shelf.
So in other words, just to make sure that there was no ship bumping into the side of the glacier, I hate to keep obsessing over the Titanic, but a la Titanic kind of thing, is that it? The winds? Was that the reason?
Yeah, I think
Yeah, I think we were able to get, I think a little bit closer than expected when we did that first pass along the glacier face because it was so still. So I think for safety reasons, they wanted to stay a little bit farther away. And then, like I said, a lot of the science that they wanted to do a bit closer to the glacier, they can't do in that kind of weather. So the one thing they were able to do was mount portions of the seat for farther out. So I think it was probably both a safety thing and a science thing, what we did when we had those big, heavy, gusting winds.
You know, Carolyn, since Marjorie is proving yet again to be the queen of digression, can I continue that theme before we get to the science for a minute? I was talking to Chelsea, our lead producer, this morning about you and being there. And we were both wondering, do you know what's going on in the rest of the world? Are you following or are you able to follow what's... Because the reason I asked that was, Marjorie, and you mentioned the 60 knots, there's this Norwegian cruise ship that tilted because of the wind the other day, and I thought of you right away. Do you know what's going on in the rest of the world?
Not really.
Oh, no.
Very strange after working in a newsroom, you know, for so many years. But we don't really have the internet. We have email, but not really much by way of the internet generally. So, but there is the New York Times Digest is downloaded onto the intranet on the ship every day. So that's like 6 pages at a time. So we get the headlines. But, you know, I don't even check that every day because things are just so busy here on the ship and there's so much to be doing all the time. So I think I learned of the upcoming Cohen hearings from your producer when she said you were going to be busy covering that last week or whatever it was.
So you don't know that WGBH moved to Virginia. You haven't gotten that memo yet or... So we're talking to Carolyn.
I'm gonna go back home.
We're talking to Carolyn Beeler on the Thwaites Glacier. So Marjorie started by talking about how you're, you know, a week or so into the science at Thwaites. Run down what's going on the science front. What's being done that you're reporting on there, Carolyn?
Yeah. So to be clear, there has been science going on for more than a week. It's just been in, you know, adjacent areas that are also important to understand
right, okay.
the processes in the sea here. But right in front of Thwaites, there's been some taking of cores, of sediment cores of the seabed in front of Thwaites. And the idea behind that is to learn from the sediment record what happened to Thwaites in the past, study past retreat of the glacier to use that information to feed into models to better understand what future change might mean. There's also been, as I mentioned, the mapping of the seabed, which is important because the main force of melting down here, scientists believe, is this warm, salty water that originates actually up in the North Atlantic, getting it under the floating underside of the ice shelf here. So better understanding troughs in the seabed, which basically act like pipes funneling this warm water under the glacier, can again help better understand what's happening with this warmer water.
Is that mapping of the seafloor, is that done in part or whole or by this unmanned ship thing, or how's that being done?
Yeah, so there are imaging technologies on the ship itself, but sort of the most exciting new scientific toy on the ship is this unmanned submarine. It's about the length of a shipping container called a Hugin. And this winter is the first time it's been deployed in polar waters. And it is sort of like a telephoto lens of taking images of the seafloor to the big ship's iPhone, maybe. So it's really high resolution imaging that it can get because it swims so close to the seafloor. And it also has about 20 other sensors that measure things like dissolved oxygen content, carbon dioxide in the water, temperature, salinity, which also gets to that issue of this warm water and how much heat it's bringing up onto the floating underside of the glacier. So that has been sort of the coolest new toy on this cruise, and it's been very exciting to see them test it out and deploy it for the first time near Thwaites.
That's Carolyn Beeler from The World. She's their environment reporter calling us from the Thwaites Glacier in Antarctica on a satellite phone. I know you interviewed the scientist who's in charge of the unmanned sub thing. Was there anxiety? I mean, this was a first, as you mentioned, in terms of the conditions in which it was operating. Was there anxiety around whether it would succeed at its mission?
Yeah, I mean, Anna Volman is a scientist you're talking about. She's from the University of Gothenburg in Sweden. And every time the Huygens surfaces after a mission, she's up on the bridge like half an hour before it's supposed to surface, pacing around, scanning the horizon for this orange submarine to start to surface on the water. She's kind of like an anxious parent waiting for a teenager to come home at night. So she's very focused. She says she's not super anxious, but she's focused. But the Huygens is very reliable. It follows directions quite well. But if you have programmed in directions for it to surface, and now there's sea ice where it was supposed to surface, then that sort of human error into the equation means you could lose your very expensive scientific instrument. So a lot of the planning that they've had to figure out down here is how to deal with rapidly changing weather conditions, including quite big waves that can make recovering the Huygens and bringing it back onto the ship difficult.
And, you know, as Jim said at the beginning when he was introducing you, Carolyn, is that the thesis is that the warming water underneath these huge glaciers is what's causing them to melt, right?
That's right. Now, that's different from other parts of Antarctica, including the Antarctic Peninsula, where warming atmospheric temperatures are playing more of a role. But it's thought, and this is pretty early science, but it's thought that what's happening at Thwaites and other parts of the West Antarctic ice sheet, which is this, big part of West Antarctica, is this, it's called the circumpolar deep water, which is pushing up onto the continental shelf, is reaching the hanging, floating front portion of these glaciers and melting it from underneath.
And give people again a sense of how big Thwaites is in terms of, on the surface and even underneath the surface.
Yeah, so the whole glacier, so the whole thing that's flowing out of this floating into this floating cliff, this floating edge that I can see, is the size of Florida or Great Britain. And the edge, this floating cliff that, I see every day out the window, is something like maybe 60, 70 feet high. But just like an iceberg, glaciers are mostly underwater, something like 9/10 underwater. So you think about a giant wall of ice and then multiply it by a lot of times underwater. That's how big it is.
It's unbelievable.
It's funny, it's really hard to tell this. Yeah, it's hard to tell the scale down here, too, because everything is so big. But it's just a massive piece of ice.
You know, Carolyn, I wasn't able to participate in the interview, the discussion you and Marjorie had last week, but I listened to it. And when I'm sitting in my car, and I hear you and Marjorie talking about the fact that you are in places where no human being has ever been before. And it was like chilling in so many ways. Are you constantly conscious of how incredible this is? I mean, it is amazing.
Yeah, it is pretty amazing. I feel very lucky to be one of the journalists selected to cover this. You look out the window. I've been trying to go up to the bridge every morning and every evening and to just take it all in and look at this massive piece of ice and icebergs, and there are lots of penguins around, and it's just beautiful. But it's also a little dissonance, because this piece of ice has the possibility to change a lot of places and people's lives around the world, including in Boston. So it's a little strange to behold this beauty and then realize the power and possible devastation it might cause someday.
And just elaborate on that for a second, Carolyn. The issue is the sea level rise that the melting of Thwaites could mean, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And we're not talking about next year or anything, but this, it's the size of Great Britain, this glacier. So it has the possibility to raise, this one glacier has the possibility to raise sea level by feet in something like 100 years. And it's also the linchpin of the West Antarctic ice sheet. So it's thought that if this really starts to destabilize and retreat even faster than it's moving now, that could lead to even further sea level rise. So it's a big mission of what's
the big mission of the scientists down here is to get a better sense of how much it might push up sea level so that places like Boston can better plan for the future.
We're talking to Carolyn Beeler, who's out in Antarctica studying the Thwaites Glacier, and it's doomed to set a place where human beings have never been before. Let's talk about these seals. I know that you're, the scientists up there are tagging seals. And now I just want to make sure. I looked at the seal pictures, and it looked like they had, like, some massive half a TV set in their heads there, Carolyn. I mean, why are they tagging them? And are these seals okay?
Yeah, so the tags do look really funny. They're about the size of an iPhone, but maybe like four times thicker, and have this big antenna on them.
Yeah.
And they're on the sort of the back of these seals' heads. So they look... they look funny, but the seals are anesthetized when they're applied, and so the scientist who's doing this work says they don't remember the experience, just like humans don't remember going under for anesthesia. And when I was able to observe this process, and the seals sort of dance around for a minute or two because they don't know what these humans are coming at them, and so they look a little agitated during that process. But otherwise, they wake up, they're fine. I saw one that was tagged just slipped back into the water after it woke up and was safe to do so and just kind of swim around. So
okay.
They don't seem too worried about it. And the tags come off after a year during molting. And the data is, you know, the data is really important because these seals measure temperature and salinity and other things that are important to figuring out what's going to happen with this glacier every day for a year, even in the winter when no other scientific instruments can be down in a place like this.
So what else is going on up there? I know we talked before about ping pong tournaments, time in the sauna, bridge games. anything new to pass the time when you guys are not out collecting data?
Well, they're really in the heart of the science right now, so there's not a lot of free time. Everyone works 12-hour shifts, and then
wow.
All the diversionary activities are a bit on hold. Actually, the ping pong final keeps being postponed.
Oh no! And what's the food been like?
The food is quite good. One of the chefs is from New Orleans, so this week we had.
Oh, wow.
Because it's Mardi Gras, I believe. We had some jambalaya and some gumbo, and he made a king cake last night. So, you know, it's a sort of cafeteria-style buffet, but better than your average cafeteria, I would say. We did just run out of fresh vegetables,
oh.
So that's a bit of a bummer. But they made them last about 5 weeks, which I'm pretty impressed by.
And, Carolyn, before you left, you talked about preparing for seasickness. When you had that terrible storm, I presume the waves were quite high. I mean, was it the ship listing, or what was that like?
Yeah, it was a bit wavy. It was not as bad as coming through the Drake Passage at the beginning of the trip. I did not feel seasick. This ship is known for being quite stable, so it wasn't too bad.
So what is the next? We're going to obviously talk to you next week, as we've been doing, Carolyn Beeler from The World. What's on tap, as far as you understand, in the coming week?
So there's going to be more of this coring, more mapping of the seabed, and more oceanographic measurements taken. But soon we're actually going to be leaving the Thwaites Glacier area and heading to its neighbor glacier, Pine Island Glacier, which is part of this West Antarctic ice sheet that's so in peril. So these systems are really intertwined. So the scientists on board also want to study this other glacier, which more is known about than Thwaites, but a lot more study will help them better understand what's going to happen to this whole system, because ultimately it's not just Thwaites we're concerned about. It's the whole region.
By the way, you're quite the photographer, too. I should say
your
pictures are really powerful.
Yeah.
They're really, really great, Carolyn.
Well, like myself, can't ruin the views down here.
Carolyn,
good luck.
You.
It's great to talk to you yet again.
Can't wait to talk to you again. This is great stuff. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Yeah, of course. Happy to do it.
Okay. Talk to you soon.
Marjorie, you have the same reaction. When you were interviewing her last week and she said, no human.
It's unbelievable.
I don't know if I'm overreacting. I don't think I am. It is unbelievable as a reporter to be in a setting where you know that nobody else in the history of the planet has ever been.
So to be out in a place that's so cold and so unforgiving and mm-hmm. so, I mean, you're talking about just just glaciers and ocean and nothing around you. I mean, it's really, I don't think I'd do as well as Carol. Let's put it that way.
Did you read her story, though, about going into the Starbucks on the glacier? Did she,
I missed that mention one, Jim. To you?
They had a limited menu, but it was better than nothing at all.
Starbucks, you can't go anywhere.
Howard Schultz was there, actually. It was
you were refining his campaign performances.
No, I am really jealous and impressed. Okay. Her reporting's been great. You should
it
check
has been
it
great. The world's Carolyn Beeler is aboard the Nathaniel B. Palmer on this expedition studying the Thwaites Glacier. She's got about 2 more weeks to go. You can follow her journey on the world, theworld.org, and on Instagram at PRI The World, and it's really worth checking out, even for non-science geeks like myself. Anyway, we are done. Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. You can find us 24/7 by way of our podcast, on iTunes or at the App Store. Tomorrow we're going to be joined by Sue O'Connell, Andrea Cabral, Ali Narani of the National Immigration Forum.
There's a lot of news on that front.
There certainly is. I want to thank our crew, Chelsea Murs, Amanda McGowan, Tori Bedford, Jason Tureski, Arjun Singh, our engineer, John the Claw. Parker, what's on TV tonight, Jim?
Well, one thing we're doing is I finished watching Leaving Neverland last night. I know you haven't seen the whole thing yet. You should see it. And we're going to talk about it. And joining me are two perfect people. Renee Graham wrote this fabulous piece in the Globe the other day, the title of which was R. Kelly is Canceled. Is it Time to Cancel Michael Jackson? So we're going to talk about the thing you and I often talk about, separating, if one can, the art from the artist. And a man who knows as much and has been as deeply into this issue as probably anybody on the planet, Mitchell Garabedian, who obviously has represented hundreds, if not thousands, of survivors of sexual abuse. They will join me. We'll be doing that tonight at 7 o'clock on Greater Boston.
Sounds excellent. I am Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browdy.
Thank you again for tuning in. Please tune in again tomorrow and have a great afternoon.